Now you have the opportunity to buy a unique poster containing a screenshot of every single millennial stream ever. The entire smorgasbord, the full gamut, the whole shebang, all in one incredible display commemorating the first decade of this festival. Available in portrait or landscape. Buy yours now.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. This is now the Canada Banquet, and there are three guests just now, but others will presumably drop in later on. So I will welcome Fortisax, Dimes, and the Course of Empire, all of whom have appeared on Millennial before. Fortisax this year, the Course of Empire, I think it was last year, and Dimes, I think the year before that.
Yeah.
So welcome, guys.
Thank you.
What's up, Mike?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, just to get things started, I guess I'll ask what do you think about Justin Trudeau?
A great guy. Love him. Can't get enough of him.
After everything that's been going on with Elon Musk, if Trudeau seems kind of quaint. The discourse has moved off of Canada momentarily. So now it's like, yeah, he's just this guy with a beard who everyone hates, and he's just hanging around. Like I've been saying for a long time, he had the opportunity to really capture a good divorced guy energy, and he's not taking advantage of that yet. But he got divorced, he got a beard. I thought this guy, he's capable of anything. And what he's done is become kind of a tyrant, which is cool. But he is still an inept piece of shit and completely counter to all of our interests.
Yeah, he's got the same dictatorial, authoritative attitude as his father without any of the intelligence or the competence.
Yes. Yeah, he has no intelligence at all. He was very, shall we say, poorly treated in British Columbia the other day when he was skiing and a woman re-rated him. That's one thing that you get in Canada that you definitely can't get in the United States. You'd never get close because Secret Service would take you down before you even got close. But in Canada, you can go right up to the Prime Minister and give him a piece of your mind. And yeah, she did.
Imagine George W. Bush was president, because if anyone's old enough to remember that, there was a consensus in America and Canada that was fuck this guy, and they made mugs and they made hats, and that was just the thing. So everyone in Canada, out where I am, I'm in Ontario, it's been fuck Trudeau for a while now, and people are just owning him while he's jogging and throwing bags of shit at him. I haven't seen anything this bad.
Yeah,
I'm kind of amazed that there hasn't been a Mangione moment yet, like with how close and how low security everything is. Like it's actually just crazy.
Well, remember, was it the election? I think it was the last election when people were throwing rocks at him.
Yeah,
like they were absolutely pelting him. They were screaming every obscenity under the sun and just pelting him with every piece of stone and rock they could find, pretty much. And one guy, I think he did go to prison for that specifically, but I don't, you know, they might have been mostly smaller, like pebbles, but nevertheless, the fact that they even got close enough and they were doing that, you know, for an extended period, that was quite mind-boggling. It just showed, though, the absolute hatred for him. And he didn't get the majority of the votes. I mean, people keep saying, why do you guys keep voting for him? He doesn't. keep getting the majority of the votes. It's just the way the votes are distributed, right? And it's so concentrated in Southern Ontario, to a great extent Quebec, and parts of British Columbia, mostly Vancouver. Yep. Yep. And then once you get outside of that, it's like nobody would vote for them. Now it's changing more based on what they're saying, at least. Last I saw, there was a poll, I believe, a little while ago that said he had like 7%. It was one poll, at least. 7% of the popular popular vote supporting him. Like, that's absolutely.
Well, there's been a number of writings that just totally flipped, like,
yeah,
in the last year alone that nobody was expecting to. And like certain like Toronto suburbs are like flipping to CPC, and like a significant portion of Quebec is flipping to CPC.
Mm.
You know what, if I could just amend what I'd said previously, is that I don't think people hate Trudeau. Not like people hate Trump, which is why I don't think you would ever see any sort of attempt on his life. The vibe is different. It's more like there is
a nationwide to let him live in a way.
Well, it's like there's a green light to bully him. That's the vibe I get. So yeah, it's not like people are frothing. And I was on a stream with a buddy of mine named Last Things, who I'm sure quite a few of you know. But I'd kind of gone off for a minute saying that no one is as angry as they should be. We skipped that part and we went right just to sort of black pill defeatism and then just bullying him. But like, I don't detect, even among nationalists, even among the people who ought to be frothing at the mouth for what he's been trying to do, I don't even detect that. And maybe that's a Canadian thing. I don't know. But it's for that reason, I don't think you'd ever see anything more than what we're seeing now.
I should say welcome to Endeavor, Giant Geo, and Davis Arini.
Thanks for having me.
I think all of you have appeared on Millennial in the past. Arini updated you. Hold on. There you go. Hello.
I was supposed to be off work, but good luck booking a helicopter in the north part of the province this time of year. Been snowed out twice. So instead of sitting at home, I'm on the road.
Right. Well, thank you.
You fucked up not doing this from a helicopter. That would have been pretty cool.
Oh, I love helicopter. You know, I get a cold, like, shiver in my gut, though, because back in the Army, anytime they said, hey, who wants to go on a helicopter ride? If you were stupid enough to raise your hand, you wound up just loading sandbags into the back of a truck for 8 hours. There was no helicopter ride, just pain.
I do love the idea of doing a live stream from a helicopter. That's absolutely ridiculous.
It's just so fucking loud. Every few seconds, like, huh? Huh? What?
Davis, I gotta tell you, when I went to tag you this morning on that post to sort of just promote the Canada banquet, the first name that came up was an account called Terry A. Davis MJ Arini. And I still,
you know what?
One of the funniest things I've ever seen.
I mistook that for I forgot who Terry. Like, I knew who Terry Davis was, but it didn't click the first time I saw that account. So I blocked the guy because I thought it was just I don't know, impersonation or something. But no, that's fantastic, and what an honor to be associated with Terry Davis. God bless that man. May he rest in peace.
So, Lowe's, how are we comparing right now to the German one? Because I set a goal of just being the best banquet so far. And are we shitting on Germany thus far?
Well, the German one was very German. It was very formal and polite. And they didn't interrupt each other. There was no sort of raucousness at all, which was the idea with the banquets, was that they would be very informal and laid back. So it was but I had to start with the German one because that was the only one Sellner could do. Then it turned out that he was ill, so he didn't take part anyway. But yeah, it to answer your question, all of them have been more like, I did the USA one last night, and then the English one just now, and now the obviously Canadian one, and they've all been very different. So yeah, the German one was an exception.
It's going to be the Canadian one that can't stop talking about Hitler, ironically. Who said that?
I was going to say that when you mentioned a live stream from the helicopter, I was going to ask, is this a Chilean helicopter where we can throw communists out?
Oh, yeah, like you guys know the term stochastic terrorism? But when you're talking about the lack of security around Justin Trudeau, I'll tell you, over the past several years, there's a tweet I haven't posted that would have been stochastic terrorism, pointing out all of the benefits that people like Andrew Breivik enjoy while they're in prison. And, you know, I've never posted that tweet, and I'm proud of the self-control.
If I know anything about Gio, my good friend Gio, he's sweating right now.
Yeah, the optics here are not good. You want some deep Davis Cerini lore. Speaking of stochastic terrorism, do you remember Davis Orion and Matt Fournier?
Yes.
That was hilarious. Yeah, that was amazing.
So, Davis, go on.
Oh, no, I'm just sorry I didn't go further. That was my my Sam Hyde moment. Shout out to Sam Hyde if he sees this. That guy's solid. I love his podcast.
Davis, I used to watch your videos 15 years ago when I was a mid-adolescent. I need you to know that. I need you to know that Kane lives, and you were the one who gave me my taste in scotch, all right?
By the way, anybody, if they have that video of me role-playing the scene from Command & Conquer, please send it to me. Computer died a long time ago. YouTube got crushed. I don't have that video anymore, and I really want it.
I think we could get Woz to go through the archives. I'm sure he's got something somewhere.
Well, I've only got some of Davis's videos. The ones that I don't know. I think I downloaded them for I don't know, for some reason. But I deleted each one as I watched it. I don't know why what the hell I was doing. But anyway, so I only had about half of them when his channel got taken down. So I was able to give him some of them, but the others I don't have. But yeah, so if there is anyone out there who has copies of Irini's videos, please do get in touch with him on Twitter so that we can rebuild the archive, because I really enjoyed Irini's videos, especially that, as I've said before, his channel was a huge inspiration for mine.
Well, thank you.
I know we spoke about Justin Trudeau a few minutes ago, but did anyone see the post that he put out today? So I can read it out right now. He said, "For a lot of people, this is the hardest time of the year. It can be the loneliest. It's a good time to check in on the people in your life who may be struggling could use support."
That a cry for help?
Well,
I think that was a cry for help.
It could have been. I mean, it could also. I mean, I just hope that he doesn't. I just hope that none of these people suggest their family members get professional help, because in Canada that might just mean that they're going to get euthanized or something like that.
Well, you know what? It's very out of character for him, because what he normally would do, it's the best time of year, Diwali or some shit like that.
Kwanzaa. Happy Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa has been it's part of Canadian culture.
Yeah, we have so many blacks.
Oh, don't get me started on Juneteenth. I had a friend. Like, I've been friends with this guy. I've been friends with him for 20 years when I saw him promoting Juneteenth on Facebook. And I said to him, What do you think you're doing? And he said, No, here's what you got to figure out, man. And he's doing the CIA BS. What we got to do, we promote Juneteenth, and then we can get them to vote conservative. Then the conservatives will be in power, because we've completely corrupted our values. I haven't spoken to him since that date.
He's got sort of like a last day of school vibe, where you can, it's carte blanche. You can do whatever you want. And what I want to do is communicate to him, however I can, if he's listening, do what I did on the last day of school and go full blackface. Go full black body.
Go full Trudeau. Well, I have a theory about like why Trudeau doesn't incur that much ire. Right? Well, he does in a way, but I think with Trump, there is a sense that Trump is a world historical figure, and that really enrages the political left in ways that would have this sort of cinematic quality to an assassination attempt. Whereas, I don't condone Fed posting or whatever, but I think Trudeau, I don't know if he's pretty much seen as a functionary or someone that isn't exactly at the wheel, even though you could argue that he has been probably the most consequential prime minister, maybe since his father, at least since Jean Chrétien. So I don't know. There's this weird thing where he's sort of above hatredness in a weird way, in the sense that he's sort of like, there's nothing there. Like, there's an idea of Trudeau, some kind of abstraction. So, yeah.
You can, and you can shake his warm hand.
He may have destroyed the Liberal Party. Like, he might have been the stake through the heart of that entire organization.
Well, like, you were saying, like, the fuck Trudeau flags. Like, I remember when there used to be, like, fuck Harper t-shirts. Like, potheads would always wear them. Which is funny because, like, the god of all potheads in Canada, Mark Emery, became, like, pretty based recently. So, you know, he's, like, talking about immigration and stuff like that. So, like, that's an indication of, like, how bad it is. Like, Trudeau was sort of, like, the millennial, like, what would you say? Like, millennial shithead libertine candidate.
But now, no, he was Obama. Like, he is basically like Canadian Obama. That same demographic, yeah, across the border. 100%. That
not
voted
only that
for Obama
when,
would have voted
when
for
he
Trudeau.
Was running. People said that outright. They said he's our Obama. I remember that. Yeah.
And he's well loved by, or at least he was well loved by women. I remember about a year or so before the election in 2015 when he got voted in. A friend of mine who was involved in municipal election politics went to Vancouver for a meeting of all the municipal politicians, and they were discussing things. And then he came out, and it's this long lineup of young and middle-aged women, and they're all just like, you know, just excited. And he asked some guy who worked there, "What's going on? Is there like a rock star here or a big sports celebrity, whatever?" "Oh no, Justin Trudeau's in town." And his immediate thought was, "Oh no, we're in a lot of trouble." He figured that was it.
If you are an elite human capital proponent, I'm not saying anyone here is, but if anyone knows what that is, Trudeau is the coolest guy in the world still. Like, I can imagine a Richard Spencer or Rich Hanania type.
He's the Hanania in Canada. He's the Richard
Hosty candidate. Yeah. He's handsome. He's a legacy guy. He boxes. You know, he's kind of tyrannical now. Like, for some people on our side, he's the shit.
Yeah. And he's really tall, which also appeals to a lot of women.
He's surprisingly like 6'2". He's like 6'2 or 6'3".
I thought he was 6'4", but yeah, he's definitely quite tall.
Well, I mean, 5'11 is basically 6'2", so I don't know what that has to do with
anything. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. You remember the boxing match? He boxed, what's his name, Brazo?
Brazo,
but that guy,
yeah.
Like, yeah, he went to jail because like, he beat his wife or something, which is, you know. Yeah, that was crazy. That was like the Sun News days. That was like when you had like Ezra Levant and all those like Kohler grifters fueling all these like e-celebs into America. That's, you know, I have a theory that basically the culture war in America now, Canadians inspired a lot of that for nefarious purposes, maybe, you know, considering Ezra Levant, you know, but I think like there's a hidden history there between the cultural politics of Canada being upstream, or what would you say? Yeah, like upstream from the inevitable American culture war. And I think like recently with the Indian issue, the H-1B thing, that's like such a rude awakening for Americans. Whereas if you're in Canada, it's like, you know,
But it's been going on here for quite a while. Yeah.
You know, what's interesting is like my entire life, whenever it came to Canadian political commentary, they always used to say that, Canada was one-tenth the U.S. population, one-tenth the economy or the economic size, and like 10 years behind politically. I don't know how true that is. In fact, I would even say for my entire life, or at the very least like half of my life, like the last 15 years has been – Canada is just like the accelerationist state of North America. It's just like everything that could go wrong.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of ultra-liberal, kind of neoliberalism, mass immigration, the gender cult, DEI, all of that stuff just hammered Canada like year after year after year over the last decade. And it's almost like we're cutting edge. Like, you know, there's that joke where that came from that article where it's like Canadians are overrepresented in far-right politics on online spaces. And this is even more insane because if you look at the chart of total numbers of internet users per nationality, Canada's actually dropped like over the last 25 years. So there are even less Canadian users proportionate to the total across the world of their presence. And yet they're so overrepresented in political and dissident spaces.
That was the case 10 years ago, even because I remember there was obviously Stefan Molyneux, girl rights, the whole MRA crowd. And of course, Arini, who's here right now,
And Gavin McInnes, and like a lot of these guys who went to America later.
Absolutely,
yeah, Lauren Southern.
Faith Warren, Goldie.
Southern Rebel Media, all of that.
Remember Faith Goldie's lip scraper?
Oh, no. You know what's crazy is that Faith is the only one who won at the end. Like, she's the only one who didn't go down in flames. She married
I like Faith.
She got too red-pilled, though.
Yeah. I thought she was a decent commentator. Yeah, I actually have my own kind of anecdotal story about this. So last spring, so this would have been spring 2023, I went to a conference which was hosted by Frode Midyard, and it was in Tallinn, Estonia, so quite a ways away from Canada. But I'd say there was around 60, 65 people, maybe 70 that attended, and I think I counted about 13 or 14 different Canadians. So, we were about a quarter of the people in attendance, and this is way off in the far reaches of Europe. So we were way overrepresented, which was kind of cool to see because I think most of them, just like me, were from Toronto. I asked, I bumped into about six or seven different people who were also from Toronto there. I mean, that city really has a way of red-pilling you. That's what all.
Yeah.
Our martial spirit. Like, the Canadians have always been volunteering to be at the front lines of every single war that's happened. Mm-hmm. I wonder if, this is our political war that we are stepping up for.
You hear Yankees? We run this shit.
I was talking to Fortisax about this quite a bit, and a lot of it has to do with Canada very often standing at the forefront of new media, because there's an interesting phenomenon there where Canadians are at the head of discourse, especially discourse in new and emergent media. However, I think up until fairly recently, they've lacked the sort of building of fraternal networks and event buildings, things that America and the UK have done. We're very online, and part of that's geographical. Part of that is that we're very spread out. Part of that's that we lack a lot of the entertainment infrastructure that America has had. So we've often had to kind of do it ourselves or move to America to make it big. So there's always been this culture, this do-it-yourself culture. And then that's kind of, I think, explains why we're here. However, especially in the nationalist scene, I think we're still kind of playing catch-up to a lot of the just basic hard work that has been done in America and the UK. Not to say that we're not doing it, but I think we're being a bit more serious about it presently.
Yeah, but I mean, the problem is a lot of guys a lot of them are railroaded by the Canadian government. I mean, for example, like if you lurk a lot of these like Canadian Antifa people, when they're not like fighting amongst themselves or like fighting against that one, who's that like fake lawyer woman, the like mixed race fake lawyer woman, Karima something, they all hate her. Like they think she's like an Andy No or whatever. But they have like this elaborate theory that every single Canadian right winger is being funded by like some dark money from the U.S. and like the whole trucker thing was essentially like an American psyop, which I think is like fucking bullshit. When you're a Canadian, you have friends in America, and it's just things work out organically. Like no doubt that maybe some people are getting money somewhere, but it's just that America is the bigger market for any sort of niche or dissident thing, and so it makes sense to appeal to an American audience. I mean, what I do, I appeal like most people that watch me are in America. So it's like not a big secret, but they have these like weird theories that like all Canadian dissidents, they're like funded by America or there's some kind of like, I don't know, dark Silicon Valley bullshit going on. I don't know.
That's a great point, Gio. I just want to say, looking at the analytics of our show, Blood Satellite, huge, I'd say like a third of our audience is from the UK, and it's a lot of America. Comparatively, it's not even a lot of Canadians. And the joke was that most Canadians are just content creators and don't even consume much Canadian content.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say on that, so firstly, that's obviously conspiratorial, and it's Trudeau left liberalism. That's been like the strain going back the last 50 or 60 years. And it's rooted in legitimate stuff, but it's just been kind of diluted as the decades go on. But another thing I wanted to say too is that, as I commentated recently, Canada skipped the classical liberal phase that the US did. Like we went straight from neocon, like kind of neoliberal Harper conservatism, straight to like whole-blown global homo stuff. Whereas all of the Canadian content creators, like the Petersons, McInnes, all these people just up and left. Lauren Southern, they all up and left to the States or Australia or wherever else. And then they influence the kind of set the groundwork foundationally for a broader civic nationalist kind of movement. But like that just never happened in Canada because like they all left. Not only did they all leave, but I would argue, and I have argued, that Canadians are more temperamentally conservative in that way. They don't respond to libertarian ideas.
I've got a theory as to why that is. This is something I picked up from, I follow a lot of the true crime, missing persons, missing 411 stuff. And one of the things they discovered was that here in Canada, the privacy laws prevent police forces from releasing information on crimes. So when they start looking into a missing person in Canada for their channel, there's no FOIA request. It's like, here's their name, here's when they disappeared, and even if I want to tell you anything, I'm not allowed to tell you anything. And so, like, I feel ashamed to myself for not knowing, like, I know way more about American politics than I know about Canadian politics, about Canadian crime, about Canadian anything. And I think a part of the reason is there's just not that much information. Part of, like, we don't have any crime statistics from Canada. We don't have any crime stories from Canada. We just have everybody on the ground is seeing the exact same thing. Like everybody I talk to, if they find out, you know, what I do, like if they find out my old YouTube channel, they loved it. They loved the crap out of it. But there's nothing in particular to talk about Canada. So we wind up talking about the United States.
They're also the giant right beside us. They're the elephant, and we're the mouse, you know, as was mentioned years ago. I think it was Pierre Trudeau.
A mouse with a gag
on it.
Was
Pierre Trudeau.
Yeah, yeah. And their media is just immense. Like, it overwhelms us to a degree that no other country can appreciate because they're not right beside them, right?
I mean, well,
Mexico, maybe, but they have a language issue.
England.
Sorry
to interrupt you there.
But I wouldn't say quite to the same degree because, or for as long, because there was, in the past especially, the UK would have to wait maybe a little longer to get shows to go over there. Now it's like immediate, of course. But here it's been like constant, decade after decade. I mean, going back to the radio era and everything else, it's just been very, very American centric, and we're just kind of, you know, absorbing that all the time.
We used to have good media. Like there was a time where, because of our size relative to America and because of the nature of public broadcasting, there was a sense that, for example, like the National Film Board did pump out a lot of classics that eventually would go to America, and there's certainly Canadian media that people know besides like the stereotypical, you know, Trailer Park Boys or whatever. But there is like such a sense of stagnation. Like all those CBC Gem shows are such shit. Like, it's, who watches them? I don't know. They're for free, aren't they? So
what's interesting about like the CBC had like a protectionist, a cultural protectionist policy for a really long time, and like I'm pretty sure it was Pierre Trudeau and the Liberals who sort of forced them to play like 90% of their content or something to that effect had to be
CanCom.
Canadian media. CanCom, exactly.
Yeah.
But aside from that too, like we actually produced throughout the 90s like an insane number of globally popular cartoons. Like Red Boy is one of them.
Ripping
Friends.
In the late 80s, I saw
fuck off.
No way.
No, seriously. It was a lot of Canadian cartoons were exported to Britain. I saw the Raccoons, Teddy Ruxpin.
Oh, the Raccoons, I saw when I was a little kid. Oh
my God. Are you
seriously?
Yeah.
I was going to say, made a good point there. That there's a lot of.
So was like Cyril Sneer like an anteater or something? What was up with that?
He was great.
Sorry, are you telling me Ripping Friends was Canadian? That's fucking crazy.
Yeah, I believe Spumco, they sublet it out to Canada, and like John Kay had a bunch of Canadian creators working on it, so yeah.
Oh, no wonder it was so messed up.
There was another one as well, but I can't remember what it was now. But definitely Teddy Ruxpin and the Raccoons, for sure.
Kids in the Hall, Twitch City.
Fortisax made a good point there where he said, like, aside from the cartoons, there's a lot of cultural commentators, there's a lot of content creators, but there's not a lot of media or informational content that's produced just about Canada. And even with the case of Rebel Media, you got the sense that as soon as he wanted to build a bridge to the UK, right? He just wanted in on the Tommy Robinson thing.
Yeah, you got Tommy Robinson's grift, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't seem to be, and this is still the case, that there's not really a deep interest in Canadian history and the Canadian context. And this is something myself and Fortisax talk about a lot. That's what caused me to create that short little documentary, Paving Over the Public, recently, just about what is the story of multiculturalism in Canada. There's nothing out there that just explains very simply what the fuck is going on. And I think we've seen with kind of the popularity of that short documentary that people like hearing this stuff. It is interesting, but it's not readily available anywhere.
Yeah, well,
right, so two more things about the
ethnic issue.
Two more things about the legal regime in Canada. So we don't have human rights in the same way that you have them in the United States. We have justices of the peace who were, think feudal lord. Think a local lord that was expected to be a good justice of the peace. So they have extensive powers, very little oversight, but they're typically merciful. In contrast to the American system where you always get your day in court, we have JPs that prefer to settle things out of court, first of all. And second of all, and this is something I picked up because, well, I was antiquing with my girlfriend, and one of the things I found was it was a book of this is what happened this year of 1938 in Canada. And so the government commissioned it, wrote it, and sent it all across the country just to keep everybody on the same page. So we have this older aspect to Canadian civil life, which it's almost a medieval sort of aspect where we have a very centralized narrative structure. And well, right now, they don't want us knowing anything. What? Don't worry about immigration. What? Suddenly every single Tim Hortons is staffed by Filipinos and Indians? What? You're making that up. You don't know that. So yeah, there's been a great information blackout for us Canadians.
I think that that narrative control has been cracking over the last 10 years specifically. Mm. And what I've noticed is that especially with Musk's acquisition of X, the information black wall having been lifted, people are either flipping or they're quadrupling down on Canadian mythology. They're quadrupling down on this sort of left liberal global end of history kind of ideology.
Transnational progressivism, you could say.
Yeah, so you get a lot of these insane shitlib accounts, like that Vicky Campbell or whatever, and they're just like, how? Rachel Gilmore, exactly. And it's like they're being exposed to all of this blatantly, like, objectively true information, like migrant attacks or all of these, or jeets crashing semis into businesses or off of highways or whatever. And it's like when you lift a rock up and you see these bugs squirming, like, in the sunlight, like, it's led to a total mental breakdown of them.
Yeah.
One thing I'd love to start in the new year, and I don't know how I'd go about this, is once again making one public-facing, comprehensive piece just about what the fuck is going on with Aboriginals in Canada. How do tribal bands work? Let's return to the residential school thing, the mass grave thing, which was a total fraud and a hoax. But let's explain that whole story, because that fell apart, and we haven't really analyzed that.
They're still pushing it. That was so amazing to watch play out, because it seemed like, you know, like certain other historical events where you suddenly are just not allowed to question this. It No. definitely happened. It definitely happened exactly as we're saying, or even worse. And there was a push. You're an evil person if you doubt it. But Yeah. the thing is with this, as far as I know, there's no evidence for it whatsoever.
Not in the way they say, anyways. No. Like, yeah.
At least with stuff during World War II.
There definitely was a lot of Indigenous kids that did die in these schools, but they usually died from diseases and other things, and
was prevalent elsewhere too, and yeah, more so on the reserves, far more on the reserves.
And
no one wants to talk. They were 100 years old.
Okay. Let's hear from Irini.
Oh, So a really important aspect of this, just 2 points about the natives. First, I was at the closing of the Indian village at the Calgary Stampede the year all of that started, what, 2 or 3 years ago. And the native chief, the elder, whoever, like the master of ceremonies at the closing, he briefly mentioned it with an offhand, yeah, okay, we've heard it, like, yeah, yeah, it's nothing new, and I don't want to obsess about it. Very dismissive, unlike the CBC, who endlessly pushed this on us. And the second thing is, all of the natives I've met that have their lives sorted out, are they have no opinion on it. They're not pro-scub, they're not anti-scub. They actually like, yeah, I don't even think about that BS, because it's another one of these treadmills where it's, you know, somebody else is making the profit when you're the human battery.
And that'd be a good part to the story too. Like, let's actually, like, who is generating this thing? Because the suspicion is that it is in some aspect, the Aboriginal leadership that is trying to make hay out of this whole thing for completely cynical, selfish reasons. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Let's not let them off the hook here, because I mean, I'm not saying it's all of them, but a lot of the Aboriginal activists and leaders and stuff realize that they're basically
100% of the activists. Anybody that's an activist is making the thing worse. Whatever your activism is for, you're making things worse. And yeah, all of the native activists, they are part of the problem. They're not helping native people.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the problem is the chief structure in Canada has been corrupt for so many decades. I mean, the first thing that Trudeau got rid of was Harper's Accountability Act that would go in to help these communities that are basically, you know, on Manitoba and places like that, there are reservations that are almost like third world countries. And yet you have chiefs that live in mansions and things of that nature. And the way that... Okay, you know how people, the voting as well, there's something suspicious there. But although, because in America, like, I believe like almost like 90% of Indigenous people voted for Trump. So in Canada, there's just a way different culture when it comes to Indigenous issues as opposed to America, where in America, there's a sense that it's already been settled or something like that.
Well, because they turned the, it's like, it was either Geo or Endeavor touched on this, like they turned the nominal deaths that occurred at residential schools that had nothing to do, that were not necessarily deliberate, right? They turned that into this narrative that if you kind of piece together from what activists and what random Indigenous supporters of this say, you would almost assume there was like an industrial grade massacre involving like conveyor belts turning people into moccasins.
Yeah,
well, like, talk about mass graves.
My joke was that you'd almost believe that the nuns were massacring these kids via firing squad or something.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, they're pretty much dying.
Well, it's look, like people.
They're throwing them all into the fire too.
Oh yeah, who knows? Maybe they even had like a
massive crematoriums.
I remember hearing this theory that, you know, it was like if the kids didn't do well enough at the test.
I remember there was this native guy earlier this year who said that like his principal made him run 2 marathons in the cold, like in 1960s. Like,
it's fucking humble brags.
Yeah,
but, mine is 40 out.
Here's the thing, though. I think, like, you know, I hope I'm not being too much of a libtard or an optics cuck, but like, I think okay, you could say that the residential school system. You have to realize, like, that was sort of like the liberal project of its day, in terms of like civilizing Indigenous people, or quote unquote civilizing. Now, you could argue that it could have been done differently. It could have been done on reservations. They didn't have to strip children away from their parents, and there definitely was abuses. But then the thing is, when you invoke the language, it was funny because he's such a libtard himself, but Terry Glavin did have a good point in his article a year or two ago. He's like, you know, when you invoke the language of mass graves, what do people think? They think like you're bulldozing kids in ditches. And so I think like that was purposely done. I mean, whether it was the Canadian government to deflect from the clown vid things, or was it like activists themselves, you'll never really get the whole story. But it really does a disservice, I think, to like Indigenous relations, because now people are skeptical of everything, you know. You know, so that's the problem.
I
basically lost any kind of sympathy I ever had for them after 2021,
Can I just say this? We had our hands on a really great riff there where we were all just coming up with Aboriginal genocide crimes. And I'd like to return to that. We could really take that one
made
for
of human
while.
Skin.
TP's made
of human skin.
There's a reason. There's a reason, and I wish I came up with this. I did not came up with this, but someone on Twitter, someone on X called it the Hey Ahoya Cost. Industry. And I was just like,
a nun put a gun to my head and made me have sex with all the hottest white women. Oh yeah, Kevin fucking sitting feather that she did. Sure.
All right, and can I just add something? So that what they were doing at the time is they were requiring every single radio station to interrupt the broadcast every 20 minutes and play native voices. And what you would get, you'd get this introduction from the CBC. Guy. Which is very, very, very well done. Like, it's top, high, like, high quality. Now, native voices. Doo, 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 doo. And then they would cut to some, like, some guy on the reservation with an IQ of 85 and a drinking problem telling a half-remembered, no, it didn't actually happen that way, and he's stumbling over his words. They looked like an idiot. Especially contrasted to the high production quality of the introduction. And I believe that was deliberate to make them look foolish. Like, there is contempt in their pity.
Let me just say, just to touch on what Arini said, I want to make it clear that, speaking at least for myself, I have nothing against 85 IQ people with drinking problems. That's my bread and butter.
I mean, that's half my audience.
By the way, it's half your audience.
Have you guys heard of Canada's version of 1352? So in the United States, they have the 1352 rule. In Canada, we have the 538 rule.
Yeah, the
what's
natives,
the 38?
Murders.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought it'd be like drunk driving accidents.
No.
We gotta have a fourth commission to study why all these crimes are not, you know, being. Being found out to be actually done by white people when actually they're always done by themselves. It's always some family member rapes and murders their daughter or their cousin or whatever.
Oh man! It's generational trauma. If you want a brutal black pill, I suggest you look up Canadian court transcripts and then search up GLADU. The GLADU principle is like this clause in all criminal cases where basically they reduce the sentence insanely solely based on the fact that they're Indigenous.
It's wild, like, once you actually look into Canadian law. Like, we did one clip on that like 2 years ago where we actually just went through the Canadian Constitution, went through the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. People will be bewildered at what's actually in there, and then add on top of that all of the statutes and shit that they add, which is literally just, you know, let's make a decision as judges to just not send them to jail for whatever. And you actually see that happen all the fucking time.
Well, there was they go to healing lodges.
Healing lodges.
There was a case this year where some native guy in his either 20s or 30s, he stabbed a 70-year-old man in an elevator, killing him. And he basically got away with manslaughter and zero jail time. And if you read the court's transcript, it's basically just saying, oh, well, you know, he wasn't given the opportunities because generational trauma and all the, you know, the leftist bullshit that you'd imagine. And
colonialism. But yeah.
Colonialism.
It's always colonialism.
And
yeah, I tell you what.
I mean, it sounds all ridiculous, but this guy got away with murder because of this leftist bullshit in Canadian law.
They're getting away with manslaughter. Everyone on this dais right now, we're getting 30 to life for man's laughter.
13 divided by 52 times 2 divided by 99 equals bad news.
What?
Oof. Indeed.
So, you know, I was going to say before, what's interesting is that before there was this industrial slaughter narrative that existed in Canada. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I went to school in the early 2000s throughout the 2010s. And the only thing they really told us about Indigenous genocide, all the history teachers would say this, and eventually the French schools would start saying this too, although I went to an English language school. And they would say that we willy-nilly handed them smallpox blankets. And you were expected to believe that this is how the depopulation actually occurred.
Like, we had hazmat suits.
Exactly. Like, we had hazmat suits, and we spiked hundreds or ostensibly thousands of smallpox blankets, and we handed them out for trade with the intention
of... No, it was a Mountie on a suicide mission. It was a Mountie on a suicide mission.
And it's on the assumption that people back then had an understanding of microbiology like they did later on, even though believed in miasma. Yeah, they didn't understand that. So, they believed in miasma. They didn't believe in germs. You know,
it was a Mountie close-talking brigade.
Yeah.
In my piece, Nationally Reconciling the Truth, where I actually break this down and I looked into it, the only known historic record, the only known reference of smallpox blankets is a letter from James Amherst and another British general, where they discuss the possibility of it, and that's it. There's no proof that there was a plan. There's no proof of any kind of implementation. And the population of the Northeastern tribes at that point had been dwindling for the previous 120 years because of Iroquois expansion. Because the Iroquois used guns and cannons that they got from the Dutch and later the English to wipe out every single adjacent tribe, to the point where they were fighting tribes 500 miles away that didn't even know Europeans existed. We're talking past
Didn't
Michigan.
They genocide the Huron?
Yeah, they did. So they wiped out the Huron. They wiped out the Algonquin. They wiped out another Iroquois tribe that was around Montreal around the time of Jacques Cartier.
This is based off of what is essentially a group chat post taken out of context. He says, exactly. Let's try this. The next post, the letter back is, someone's been smoking too much peace pipe.
Well, I understand it was a leftist academic back in the 90s who concocted most of it. And it's also been applied to the United States, because you quite often hear in the U.S., oh, yeah, they handed out these blankets. It's like, okay, so it's happened in both countries somehow. And the whole Amherst story I've heard as well, and for them as well. But the Iroquois were a vicious bunch. I mean, a lot of the tribes would immediately run to the Brits or the French and say, can you save us? Like, we'll be your ally. These people are wiping us out. They're torturing us. They're cannibals. They're the most vicious, horrific
The reason
people.
The Algonquin actually speak French to this day is because they took refuge with the Jesuits after the Iroquois destroyed all of their villages in southern Ontario. And the mass depopulation of the Huron, at least 50 or 60% of their entire population was wiped out in a single war in the 1640s. It's absolutely insane that this 100 year war sparked between Champlain and the early French colonists from 1609 all the way up to 1700 just led to an insane industrial grade slaughter with guns and cannons. Like, you don't understand. Like, we're not talking about guerrilla hit and runs that you see in The Patriot. We're talking about regimented, like, European style warfare. And the only technology the Iroquois adopted were guns and cannons. They didn't start building their huts or their longhouses with European materials. Like, they solely, it's like a game of Civilization V, where all you do is just upgrade your military and everything else is in the Neolithic, but you're using modern guns and cannons.
Someone in the live chat has said, the notion that Canadian settlers engaged in what amounts to biological warfare during a time when germ theory didn't exist is a pernicious lie and one of the worst blood libels in existence.
In fact, from what I have read, the only record of biological warfare during the settlement of North America was when an Indian tribe was launching dead bodies into an American fort. Yes. So the only deliberate...
They did that during the Crusades, yeah.
And you would think if we were doing the smallpox plagues, we would also be doing that, and we weren't.
Yeah, we would just wait them all.
You notice that with these narratives, they just get more and more ridiculous as time goes on, just like with World War II, because I can't remember where I found this, but there was some document which asked attendees of residential schools what their experience was like. And this was like in the 1990s or something like that. I guess this is when this was just becoming a big issue. But most of the responses were something along the lines of, oh, you know, not bad. I learned some good skills there. Sometimes the discipline was a bit harsh, but it really taught me some good life skills. And I think I succeeded later in my life because of it. I mean, if they
were casually mentioned that half of their classmates were massacred.
Yeah, well, you know, my my roommate, he was killed via firing squad, but he was kind of a jerk, so you know, I didn't really mind.
I gotta cut out now, unfortunately. Sorry to interrupt. I gotta really head out now. I've had a great time appearing on this. Thank you so much for having me. Like I said, and maybe this will kick off the next talk, internet service up your fucking sucks. I had to rent a meeting room to do this because my ISP was down and they're closing now. So thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you. For
Take it easy, Dimes.
Great to meet you, Arini. Great to meet you, everyone else. I've known a lot of you online. Pleasure. But great to talk to you. Thank you so much. I'll see you guys later.
All right. See you later.
All right. Yeah, the media, up until quite recently, did have those stories that a lot of the natives had positive experiences, or at least a mixed experience. Yeah, maybe they were, you know, beaten a little bit, which was true.
Everybody got beaten back then.
Exactly. And the whole residential school system was based fundamentally on the British public school system. It was fundamentally the same idea. It was very regimented. It was very strict. They had to do this because you had people all over the place, lightly populated, and the only way you could function as a school is if you had one central location and you brought them all in a boarding school situation. And yeah, if you, you know, said anything that was slightly out of line to the teacher, you got a beating. And that's what everybody was like though then, you know, in the 1890s or 1920 even.
And they had whatever to make the choice. You had these populations in Canada that had no written language and spoke a language that nobody else understood.
Yep.
And moving forward into the 20th century, if we leave them the way they are, they're going extinct.
Yeah, it's
going
to keep going backwards more and more. Yeah, for sure.
No, but that's the catch 22. Like, sorry, I cut you off, Chris Vanner. Go ahead, my friend.
Well, we're just saying that the native families, like the parents, would beg that their children be put into these schools because they knew that. They had enough of an understanding, and they would say, don't teach in our language. Teach in English or French, depending on where you were, of course. And they wanted them to get those skills to be able to survive in the growing industrialized world that they were in. The white man's world, as the Industrial Revolution was really taking hold of Canada in the latter part of the 19th century. So,
and by the way, same thing for the deaths. Mm. So there'd been a public campaign to convince people to stop spitting everywhere around 1890, 1900 throughout Western countries. And the native populations lagged about 20 years behind that. So they were still getting the same death rates due to disease because they were spitting everywhere. And it was usually when they went home to the tribe, they brought the disease to the school with them. So, yeah. Like, we had only just stopped spitting ourselves. And, these are social programs that mostly had good effects that had a few bad effects. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's obsessively looking for any excuse to be bitter about
and
things.
A lot of those negative effects were things that everyone was doing. So it wasn't specific to white man being bad to the poor downtrodden native. It was, well, white man was doing it to his own kids too. You know, I mean, maybe we shouldn't have gone that far. That's another conversation. But
yeah, I was going to say,
if we didn't have these schools, then the narrative today would be that we were horrible because we didn't educate them. And the reason that they're less successful today is because they were denied education decades ago or centuries
ago. You can't win either way, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think you could win with that.
Someone should do an updated version for Canada.
Well, you know, that's Freudianism right there. That's psychoanalysis. It's like there's times in our life when you realize that there was something that messed you up when you were a kid. You got to, you know, slice your chest open, pull it open, and find that little bit of lead in there that's poisoning your blood and take it out. But psychoanalysis just never stops opening the person up and finding a little bit of trauma. And, you know, that one time that your dad was like, hey, Dad, I drew a picture, and he was tired, and so he didn't praise you, and now you hate him. It's like we have the whole psych. Like, this is why everyone's so mentally ill right now, is because they're going to therapists. And it's the same thing politically, where we constantly dredge through the past to find things to be angry about. There are mistakes that were made in the past. And once in a while, it's worth having a conversation about those. Yeah. But this ain't about healing. This is about stripping people apart and vivisecting them on the operating table.
Well, that's why people joke about the new holiday, the Truth and Reconciliation Day in September. It's really a grievance day. It's for white man to go around
groveling,
saying, I'm so sorry, as the self-flagellating. I'm the most evil person.
It's a raw, raw humiliation ritual. Yeah. And so I was in a conservative area in Toronto. I was at a football game. And at this football game, what I saw was an all-black team take a knee for BLM. And then immediately after that, the announcer making a speech about how a land acknowledgement. He's making a land acknowledgement combined with the BLM thing. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Like, this is...
They do that before Calgary Flames games now.
They do it everywhere.
Here's what you say if somebody makes a land acknowledgement, and it's somewhere where you can speak up. It's like, geez, that's one hell of a flex. That's like a high school bully taking your money and then saying thank you. Like, people call me racist, but geez, you must really hate natives. I mean, you're not giving the land back, are you?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's virtue signaling. It's nothing but virtue signaling. Because it's not like...
You steal the land, then you say thank you.
Now that the white man has stolen this land, we're going to give it back to you. No. It's just like, we just want to acknowledge that, yeah, this was unceded territory. You know, we didn't really negotiate this. Yeah, we were conquered, that's why. You know, I mean, it's just nonsense. It's just, this is a game that we're playing that is to pat ourselves on the back that we're trying to do something here, right? And it's not like the natives, other than, again, the usual types, the activists and stuff, but the rank and file one doesn't care about any of this. They don't care. You know, and they do have their own land. They do. They've got the reserves. We don't get our reserves. We don't. I mean, I know Devin Stack mentions this for the States too. It'd be amazing if white people had their own reserves or reservations where we got to decide everything and we could say, no, you can't live here. And these are our laws and you can't run in our political system because you're not one of our tribe, but we can't do that.
Well, who was it that pointed this out?
According to the media, there's 2,000 sundown towns in America.
It was whack.
I wish.
It was absolutely whack to see Polyev call out one of the liberal MPs for faking his indigenous blood. And then it's like, if we can acknowledge that there are immutable ethnic blocks that live in this country that have exclusive rights to determine residence based on blood quantums, like the Iroquois alone. Yeah. You either have to have full blood Iroquois grandparents, or you have to be half at minimum in order to actually live and be recognized legally
as a status Indian.
Exactly, as a status Indian in Ganawage, which is just across the St. Lawrence River from Montreal, and it's just we have open ethnic nationalists.
Oh yeah, but only for them.
Yeah, exactly. We have open ethnic nationalism.
This came up recently because the indigenous chiefs, the ones out in places like Alberta that have oil on their lands, they're cutting deals with the Chinese over the Canadian government's back. So it's pretty funny how you have a very motivated, and you know, I guess it's their right to do it because the Canadian government can't really do anything about it.
Oh yeah, they cut deals all the time.
Yeah, but it's really funny having an indigenous group an enclave in Canada determining mass amounts of resources to a foreign power, right? So yeah.
Well, then they'll do the whole environmental card, and then they'll cut a deal with some local industry that will extract all the resources. And it's like, wait a second, I thought you guys were supposed to be in touch with nature, and yet you've got this company that's just pulling everything out of the ground. It's like, yeah, whatever. What are you going to do about it, right? It's the same with the salmon thing here on the West Coast. It's like, oh, they got ceremonial salmon. You know, I know they got it in the East Coast too. Same idea. Oh, it's ceremonial, and yet they're selling it off the back of a pickup truck, you know, to anybody. It's like, yeah, you're really concerned here about the holy salmon, you know, the very ritual thing. Yeah, you really care about that. As you're
front of the truck, there's a Ford logo. Back of the truck, there's a Chevy logo.
Yeah.
You think it's like a sales pitch to get libtards to buy their food?
Of course it is.
If they say it's like ceremonial or something, some self-hating liberal will buy it.
I have friends in Europe who are totally enthralled. I sent them postcards from Canada. Some of them had indigenous stuff. They're like, whoa. do you mean an indigenous person made this? I'm like, no. I mean, it's from a tourist shop. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. It's probably made in China.
Yeah, the really sad part is it's the same toxicity that's infected our culture. Because at that, the Native village closing ceremony, there were no braves. They had a whole bunch of Native dancers. They had a couple of very effeminate Native boys wearing lots of feathers. But there was no tomahawk throwing. There was nothing masculine. So you get to glorifying your Native culture so long as you're being a whiny bitch about it. But you're not allowed to be proud. Like, it's like, if I were a Native, I'd be saying, man, we had Stone Age technology and still took you 200 years to beat us.
No, it's true. No, it literally, it's true. I got into it with this dude, one of these grifters, one of these like grievance politics, half indigenous dudes, something tail feathers yesterday. And he had the audacity to say, he's like, oh yeah, the Blackfoot.
Tail feathers.
Well, that's it. So he says the Blackfoot have lived here, have always been here. And he's talking about Alberta. I'm like, man, that's crazy. Are you sure your ancestors didn't migrate from the Northeast? Oh, well, why don't we look at that? And I posted an excerpt sourced. I used AI. I was like, find the source. And it's like, this is basic history. The Blackfoot migrated from the Northeast. They were an Algonquian tribe. And then it's like, and then I posted, I was like, what else was going on at the time? Oh, the Iroquois were genociding everybody in that area, and that's the only reason your ancestors migrated to the Great Plains? That's crazy. So it looks like ancestors...
The Bantu expansion was mostly peaceful.
That's it, right? So I'm like, your tribe has only been in the prairies for as long as the Loyalists have been in Ontario. That's what you're saying. And then, of course, no response, right?
Yeah.
Again, this is where you find that natives that have their act together, they know what they're doing, they have a nice house, they have a car. These guys are not activists. They're not even interested in it. Don't want to talk about it.
Have you ever heard of Chief Louie?
No, who's this?
He's a guy in British Columbia. And as soon as he took over as chief, his first act was to kick out all the government men. He told them, I don't want any of the government in my reserve. You're out of here.
Native build.
Yeah. And he also refused to hire any of his own people to be accountants. And they said, well, we got to be accountants too. And he said, when you finally actually figure out how to do accounting, I'll think about it. But until then, not a chance. You guys are totally useless. He would go in front of the entire, they had the whole First Nations conferences, and he would berate and belittle all his fellow chiefs, saying, you guys are a bunch of grifters. You're a bunch of whiners and complainers. You don't try to get your own people to better themselves. All you do is try to suck more money out of the teat of the government, taxpayer money. That's all you want to do. And, his attitude has been consistently, and he will do this as well. If you do not work in his on his reserve, if a member of the tribe doesn't work, you are immediately evicted. If you say, yeah, I'm just going to, sit here and drink liquor all day and never work, he says, okay, you can go elsewhere. You can go live with a white man in the city because you're not living with us. He's a rare exception, though. Very rare exception. There's a few others.
That reminds me of Russell Means in America. He was similar. He became like a libertarian after, having it out with the FBI in the 70s. And then he went on Alex Jones and everything. And he talked about the dysfunction among the reservation systems and these casinos and all that. It was basically just a grift. But here's the thing, if they wanted to live a traditional lifestyle, I think that should be encouraged. They should be reconnected with their thing. Like we were talking about before with them learning English or French. The claim is that that itself is a form of cultural genocide. But that's the thing. But Endeavor was saying, but then we would be accused of letting them still be wallowing in poverty and abjection. So yeah, you literally can't win that discourse. But I think if there is indigenous tribes that do want to reconnect with their traditional practices, that should be encouraged. It's just, that's the problem. It's always a catch-22. But anyways, do we want to talk about the other form? Do we want to talk about the Dot Indians now?
I mean, what I was going to say was that, with these land acknowledgement things, maybe they actually are trying to give the land back to Indians with the immigration policy.
Yeah. Well, it's wrong Indians.
The last thing I'll say on the indigenous question is that, on the IQ, if you will, it's that, like, there's so much about this, about land acknowledgements, and one of the browbeatings that I hear from Indians now is, you stole the land from the natives. It's like, okay, but are you giving it back to the natives? No. Then you're in possession of stolen property.
Oh my God.
Right? It's like, are you giving it back? No. You're going to bulldoze their reservations the second you get a chance.
Yep.
You know what's funny? Like, for how, like, however, like, libtarded Toronto is, it's very funny that, like, the Toronto Maple Leafs don't start every game with a land acknowledgement, but, like, the Canucks and the Calgary Flames do. I think that's hilarious. Like,
because there are so few of them in Toronto, but I don't know. Although, yeah, I've seen these things done.
There's more here in Niagara, around Niagara, yeah.
But you will see them in Vancouver for sure. Of course, they're usually just stumbling around drunk, but unfortunately.
Well, they have a lot of Salish, and they have. What other tribes they have in Vancouver?
Okay, can we transition to the Jeets? Because I've got here. This is so.
I just want
to. I'm sick of talking about natives. No, this is. I was. Look, I'm trying to listen. Yeah. I'm trying to listen a lot more, and I was working with this Jeet, and he was telling me how the Jeet scam works. So. What they do is the Pakistani especially are entirely focused upon owning land. And so even though his family owns tons of farmland over in Pakistan, he was here to buy up property. And the way they do it is they come up with fake businesses and fake incomes. And they've got this whole familial network to say, oh yeah, I'm making $300,000 a year. And they go and get a loan from the bank for a house. And then they cram like eight of them, and they work menial jobs where they get the house paid off. And he was saying to me, they are never going to square the bank loan information with the Revenue Canada information, because the banks will all go bankrupt because none of them actually qualify for home loans. And so if you're wondering why none of us can afford housing, it's because of this giant Jeet network that's figured out how to scam the banks into giving them home loans.
I used to supervise a bunch of Jeets, because unfortunately in my field, most of the employers are also getting in on the cheap foreign labor, and they were, so they're all, it doesn't matter for what purpose, it doesn't matter where they are. If they're in Toronto, Niagara, Mississauga, Owen Sound, if they're somewhere, they have group chats for everything. And I don't just mean the location or the city. I mean, even for their workplaces, they'll have group chats for their workplaces. So everywhere you go in Canada, there's a massive Jeet group chat where they just coordinate with each other. And never mind just their extended families, but with the entire Jeet community across Canada. And they just coordinate this way. It's they build their own internal economies. They have their own transactional processes, and it's exactly as you say. Some of the Sikh temples and Hindu temples give interest-free loans to a lot of these people as well. Like it's like they're building a parallel society. Quite literally, they're building a parallel society and parallel infrastructure separate from mainline Canadian existence.
If you live in the Middle East, there's no homeless people in the Middle East because the clan takes care of everybody. So we would call that nepotism, because we have an individualist society with a legal system that recognizes that. If you live in the Middle East, that is not nepotism. That is how you operate as a society. But then if you mix those two, so now we have this individualistic legal system that assumes all the kids get kicked out at 18, alongside an ancient culture doing what we would call nepotistic and speaking on group chats in a language nobody understands. Oh, that's a recipe for success.
Yeah, well, this is what the liberals
The first job I had ever had in my life was working at a fast food place, which was managed by Jeets, and half the staff were. I don't think I'm going to go into that story too much in detail here. I'm going to write a Substack article about that. But, you know, because since we're on Woe's channel and he's located in the UK, I'm pretty sure that this Substack article would get me arrested if I were in the UK. So all I can say is it was the worst experience of my life. And I'm just going to borrow a phrase from the Jews and say never again. Just never again. It was a nightmare.
I think the Americans are starting to get a taste of this now too, like with the whole H-1B thing, because they and yet there's so many of them, and they don't, they're refusing to understand it. If you do manage to rope these guys on the line, you get them and you talk to them face to face and you say, listen, meritocracy is a liberal Western idea that does not work with people who come from families that are endogamous communitarian in their structure. And they're not even doing it on purpose. They're not even doing that. Is just
the fact that this guy would tell me the scam so blatantly to my face. Well, from their perspective, they look at us white people and look, there's all the fancy homes and we've got like three cars parked out front, and they don't they don't realize that we have been going broke behind the scenes maintaining the facade. So we, like, white people are on the ropes right now. It's just that we look really good because we inherited our grandfather's fancy suit. And so he's just telling me all of this without do you know who you're telling this to?
It was another one of my colleagues who was telling me a similar thing. I'm like, how do you, I asked him, like, how do you feel about the new immigration restrictions? He's like, oh, it really sucks. And like, some people are going to have to go. I'm like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, but I found a loophole. And then he continued to explain to me how he was going to get around it. And then also that their fallback plan was the refugee program, obviously, if the TFW thing didn't work out. And I'm just like, man, why are you telling me this? Like,
or you could be an international student.
Well, exactly.
That's been a scam for years, and a lot of people just didn't realize. It's only been quite recent that they realized that the whole international student thing was a major racket. It had nothing to do with them getting an education so they could go back home and better their own countries. It was a backdoor way of getting around the immigration policy so they could stay here permanently. And it worked.
And all the colleges know it.
Well, and you guys are completely down with that. Food banks, didn't you? So
and the food bank thing too is the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, with that, not only are these quote unquote international students just going to these food banks and just ravaging them just as a scam. I mean, not only do they have not enough shame such little shame, they'll actually go on social media and brag about doing so. Mm-hmm. I mean, from a Canadian perspective. Canadian sensibilities would just see this as repulsive behavior.
Yeah,
but
completely.
I mean, should you really expect anything else from people who are from a country where people shit in the streets?
Like, they're not, what was I going to say? They don't have the looks to fit in, and they don't have the intelligence to keep their mouth shut about what they're doing. And I think
they're arrogant as other
as other groups, and it's going to be their downfall because they don't know how to subvert. They really just do not.
Well, I had that point.
And the corruption is so high. It is so high in those countries. I used to work with those people as well in one of my early jobs. This is way back. I'm older probably than most of you guys, if not all. And it was like all of them were as corrupt as, like they would say, you have no idea. You have no idea the level of corruption. Countries like Canada are pristine compared to India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, or also places like the Philippines, for that matter, where you would always have to grease the palm of the low-level functionary of the government or the bureaucracy just to get simple files to make sure that you didn't end up going to prison. So I just don't want to get audited. Oh, we can't seem to find your tax file. I'm really sorry about that. How can we fix this? Well, you know, and they put their hand out. You know, just put some money on there. And that's how it is. And that's how life is. It's all about just grifting. It's all about corruption. It's all about manipulation. And that's their entire mindset. That's their entire culture. It was when the British were in India that they put a lot of checks on that. It was never obviously perfect, and they didn't stop all of it. No way could they have. But, they did. There was that article. I think a few of you guys were circulating as well that came out. It was written by a guy from India who came to Canada, and he said, you have no idea how bad India is. It's worse than you think it is. And it's not just India again. It's the whole subcontinent. It's subcontinentals. They're all like that. And they will tell you that. Like, the more decent ones are like, yeah, we hate it. And they will all submit to the leader. Like, if the leader says, you're all coming in on the weekend to work free of charge, they'll go, okay, sir, I'll do that. And they'll do it. And all the white guys, and this happened to me, all the white guys said, yeah, I'm not doing that. And they kind of go, okay.
This is something that was pointed out by someone on Twitter yesterday that I think, I can't remember who it was, but
there's obviously been this explosion recently on Twitter of Indian people really spewing triumphalist hatred towards white people, especially Americans, saying that, you know, we're replacing you.
After break.
You know, white girls love Indian dick. We are successful in your country, is more successful than you, and all of that kind of thing. Mm. And someone pointed out this is their mentality because they have a switch in their head that basically they are cruel to those beneath them in a hierarchy, and they are sycophantic to those above them. Mm-hmm. And it's one or the other.
Yeah. It's so exactly that
switch has been made in their head.
Now
suddenly they feel entitled, enabled to be cruel to us. So they're doing it.
The two reasons for that are they have a shame-based culture rather than a guilt-based culture, which is what we have. Whereas, like, basically anything goes unless you get caught, in which case it brings shame to your family. And they don't have the moral compass to mitigate that. It's not like they feel guilty upon the deed that they know is wrong. They feel guilty and the shame if it comes to light. So that's one. And the other thing is the family structure. Westerners have two family structures. They have the nuclear family and they have the authoritarian family. And they're very similar, but they do deviate. But nonetheless, they're much, much higher trust family cultures, and they instill a high trust culture, and they just don't have that. And this is the way they just operate. Like two of my other colleagues used to tell me, it was two Tamil girls that I worked with who told me, we prefer having a Canadian boss. And I said, why is that? And they said, because they're fairer and they treat you better. And the second an Indian or someone else of the subcontinent gets into the boss's position, it's just like the old country. And I was like, that's crazy. That's absolutely insane to me.
No, but the thing is, their experience. Oh, did I cut you off? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that I had that experience and it was horrible. Yeah.
No, yeah. But it's funny, like, mass rampant, like, internet based globalization has really revealed, like, a lot of these cultural antagonisms in ways that were, like, not possible even 10 years ago. Like, for example, I don't know, this is, like, really crazy. I don't think I should mention this, but, like, for example, they're really I noticed, like, the invective on Twitter from like Indian Twitter against white people, like it happened on Christmas recently. I noticed, like, for a long time, I think it was Martin. He had this thing called the bingo card of, like, when an Indian nationalist replies to you on Twitter, it's always like your mother. There's, like, allusions to, like, incest and OnlyFans, and, like, because I think, like, a lot of people, like, a lot of the experience in, like, the third world in general, like, a lot of these places, they have, like, an internet connection more than they have, like, running water. So it's like, okay, what's their first experience in, say, like, some, like, third world slum or favela? What's their experience of, like, white women in particular? It's pornography. So it's like they have this, like, very, like, weird pornified view of relations in the West. And, like, you see this, like, recently with this battle on Twitter that's been going on between the E-right and the quote-unquote tech right, which I think is not a real thing. But, or, well, whatever, that's debatable. So you do see, like, this very weird, like, cultural things that come out. And as for Canada, another thing that I think is, like, maybe a secret white pill is that I noticed on, like, a lot of YouTubers that are Canadian, especially, like, ones that do, like, financial news, I noticed that they're more willing to question the problem with mass Indian immigration during the Trudeau years. And there's, like, a lot of infographics and, like, explainer video essays, stuff that you would never have, like, 10 or even 5 years ago in terms of, like, the Canadian political spectrum. So it's like, I think, like, that mass amount of cultural antagonism has, like, really woken a lot of, like, otherwise demure and polite, just normie Canadians, because unfortunately Canadians are kind of like turbo normies, a lot of them.
So listening to, what was it? It was like a good litmus test for how normies are thinking is to, like, tune into someone like Asmon Gold. Like, that's a really good litmus test to see where sort of, like, normie guys are and what, and they're all talking shit about the Indian situation. And you're right, it's actually not just the finance guys. There's a bunch of other just normal people when they talk about why they're moving away from Canada, and immigration is almost always the first thing that comes up. It's specifically Indian immigration.
Yeah, I mean, one thing you'll notice if you go on YouTube and just type in the word Canada, almost all the videos you get in your initial results are going to be why Canada's collapsing, why it isn't what it used to be, the problem with Canada, and just the list goes on and on. I've lost track of all these videos, many of which have hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of views of, you know, why Canada isn't the paradise that, or, you know, supposed paradise that it was a couple of decades ago. So, I mean, there definitely is a sense that the country is not going in the right direction. And I mean, it is kind of encouraging that you do actually see a lot of people laying the blame where it actually where it actually should be laid with the immigration policy. But you just do see this very widespread discontent, and much more so than you did even 5-6 years ago.
I think too, another white pill is that specifically because it's subcontinentals, the reaction from the feminine persuasion in Canada towards mass immigration has been excruciatingly hostile, like way more hostile than it seems to be in places like the United States or even in Europe. Like there is just something so foreign and alien and just repulsive about so many of the Indian immigrants that they're just like, no, actually, I don't want this. I don't
there,
want this.
There was this viral TikTok for it next that like it was this Asian, I think she was like, she wasn't Chinese, she was Korean or something. But she had been like born in Canada, right? And she lived in Toronto. There's this viral TikTok where she said that she went into a Tim Hortons near Bloor and Yonge. And this Indian, you know, the guy working the cashier, he's like, he handed her her coffee, then handed her an empty cup and said, can you spit in this for me? And she's like, what? He goes, oh, I'm part of a University of Toronto. I'm doing a science experiment. Can you spin the cup for me? Obviously, it was some kind of like perverted sexual thing, right? Then she calls the manager, who also was Indian, and says like, listen, this guy, he's like essentially sexually harassing me. And he's like, no, don't worry. He just came from India and, you know, he doesn't know better. And can you please not make a complaint to the head office, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's so insane. Like, you'd never have that ever. Like, because, you know, I mean, Justin Trudeau, for example, he like talks about like, I'm the first feminist head of state, like male feminist head of state ever. And, you
now
know,
spit
so,
in the cup.
Yeah, spit in the cup. And that had like millions of views.
you hear a lot of discourse, especially in the manosphere. And there's been a lot of theories floating around about why women support mass immigration. And a popular one has always been they're dissatisfied with their men. Their support of mass immigration is to punish the men. They're trying to bring virile, fresh blood. Except if you follow that logic, then the opposition to mass immigration in Canada by the women is because they're not the foreign conquerors that they want. They're nothing even remotely close to it. There's just nothing masculine or even really redeemable about that demographic.
Yeah, like I'm saying,
you get some misplaced mothering instinct. I don't know if I actually believe that.
I'm just saying that if you were to follow that logic, it's like, no, these are not desirable male replacements for Canadians.
Yeah.
They're not.
Oh yeah,
they're,
definitely. I mean, I think in that, for that question, it's more just going along with what they perceive as being the moral consensus. But I wanted to bring up that, did you guys see that ad posting for an apartment rental in, I think it was Brampton. Oh yeah, it was definitely Brampton. So it was the women only, and it had three options, and one of the options was you can live in this apartment for free if you agree to a friends with benefits relationship. And it said, oh yeah, it's an Indian guy.
Dude, Craigslist is wild. Shit. Some of the most like openly racist I've ever seen on Craigslist ads for rentals. Like it's insane. Women only, Islamic only. Sometimes if you filter it by language, it'll be obscure Middle Eastern or subcontinental ethnicities only. And they're just open about it. Some of them are like, no blacks allowed.
See, true story.
Arena, you go. Yeah.
My friend was, he moved in with, I think, three Indian guys renting the house, and he went to the washroom. And he's like, hey, guys, where's the toilet paper? Because there's just a bucket of water next to the toilet. And they're like, oh, we have to get toilet paper. There's a white guy living here now.
Holy.
You know what that reminds me
true
of?
True story.
Denver? You know what that reminds me of? That reminds me of like the Indian guy that said like only women, like if you agree to a friends with benefit relationship. That reminds me of that Razib Khan tweet where he's like adding Ayala because he like didn't get an invitation to the Ayala birthday gangbang. And it's oof. Like that's yeah. But oh, it's crazy, man. It's crazy. But no, but yeah, that's another point I will bring up is that I had this whole rant planned in, for one of my shows, but this discourse in the past few days, how there's sort of like this triumphalism in terms of like that Indians and Chinese people, that they would be like the new heirs of civilization or whatever. Like it's never going to happen, but like, this is what they say, right? Because of the sort of bullshit elite human capital meritocracy idea. But say if this happened, not to say it will happen, right? Because if you were to hand Western civil or European civilization over to another demographic, it would cease to be European civilization. But for example, they would have a huge problem with a lot of the like sort of, let's call them precariat demographics in North America and in Europe. Like for example, the Muslims in Europe that would realize, they would realize like, very quickly, they probably had a better deal with like Europeans with white people than they did with like the Chinese and the Indians administering life. Well, so they,
absolutely, yeah.
They hate each other. Like they, there are no words in the English language to describe the degree of which those groups hate each other. Like even just the Chinese and the Indians alone despise each other beyond all recognition. And they've been rival civilizations for thousands of years. And it's, you know, and the Muslims have attempted to invade the subcontinent. Actually, they succeeded. They conquered 2/3 of India, the Mughals, who were Persianized Mongol Muslims, if I'm not mistaken, conquered like 2/3 of the subcontinent with the exception of the Tamils. So like they already hate each other. It's that old phrase or that old expression where it's like, you know, when Whitey's gone, you're all going to kill each other. Like And they will prefer it.
Well, that's what happened with Africa. You had a lot of administrative populations, either Indians or Muslims or whatever, by the British and the French. A lot of them, as soon as decolonization happened, a lot of them were like genocided by the native population. So,
There's constant order
about the adverts for roommates and stuff. When they say only Indians, only Pakistanis or whatever. This kind of thing happens in Britain as well, and it always astonishes me because a white person would never dream of putting in an ad like that, only white people. And it interests me to ask, why is that? And obviously, I think the main thing is that white people simply know that if they did that, the police would visit, at the very least. They'd get a visit from the police. Very possibly their life would get turned upside down with a court case for the next year or two, 3 years. And very possibly it would result in a fine. Possibly, I don't think a prison sentence, but I guess it's conceivable.
It's the process that's the punishment. It doesn't matter.
The process is the punishment there. I mean, who the fuck wants their life turned upside down for 2 years and the worry about it and all that. So but everyone knows that is not going to happen to a Pakistani or an Indian or whatever. Or an African, indeed. Mm-hmm. And if the police did try to do that, because it's like with the fining them, you know, and you see this in America with the, they're just going to let them off. If they steal less than $1,000 worth from a shop, they're just going to be let off. I think that's in California. Because the police have learned that there's just no point taking them to court or whatever, because you're not going to get the money. So, in other words, what would be the word? Like, lack of cooperation with the system eventually leads the system to leave you alone, because it just learns it's a waste of resources. But that's happened with them. I've got to say, I think if whites tried that again, that wouldn't work either. I think that because the system is so bent against us that. It would just continue and persevere, and even if it never got the money from you, it's an ideological thing, isn't it? I mean, they would ruin your life.
Yeah, even with hiring practices, more and more people are realizing that once subcontinentals get control, like as management or whatever, they're constantly hiring their own people. And whites, sure, we kind of do that, but that's in the sense that, well, we're the majority, so obviously. But we are always bending over backwards. We got to make sure we have this group and that group, you know, represented, right? That's how it is.
Well, yeah, no, you get sued.
But you get sued, yeah. Yeah, oh yeah. But if they do it, everyone turns a blind eye and just goes, well, you know, I guess they were just the most qualified. You know, it's Elon Musk going, well, they're that 0.1%. They were all that 0.1%. All the H-1B people, they're all the 0.1%. Even though Indians are like, what, the second largest group coming in the States now, next to Mexicans of immigrants. But, you know, somehow they're all these high IQ IT people or whatever it is or in – you know, finance or in whatever, because it's not usually, well, there are some involved in carpentry and construction, but not as much.
Of like three.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's very interesting because I can't see Hispanic Americans liking Indians.
No.
As a matter of fact, I cannot see them cooperating in any capacity.
Not a chance. They prefer whites.
Well, they do, and for all intents and purposes, they're kind of half Western, not just on an ethnic basis, but even on a cultural basis. Yeah. I would categorize South and Central America as kind of their own thing, but they're Western adjacent, and mm-hmm. I can't see that working in places like Texas or Southwestern or the Southwestern U.S.
Well, many of them are virtually 100% European, depending on where they're from in Central and South America, right? And even within Mexico, it's a bit of a patchwork. Right, it's not like they're all, you know, a mix with European with the native folk or whatever. You know, some of them I've known people, they're basically all German, you know, it's like, but they speak Spanish, you know, that they were raised in Mexico, born and raised in Mexico, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, so I can't see that happening. Like that in itself is just another. You're just adding more identities into the mix. You're adding more pluralism into the mix. You're adding more factionalism. I just can't see it blowing over well.
No, they would definitely side, and a lot of Hispanics do actually self-identify as whites, whether or not we agree with them. Story.
Well, you
know the story, but you know they'll say that like, yeah, I am. I'm especially the fairer skinned ones, right? But they're not going to look at Indians as someone who is someone they would make an alliance with. They'd kind of look at them like, you guys you're very different.
you've seen that meme that's been floating around where it's like, it's usually a screenshot of a certain figure from World War II. And it's like, sir, your ideology is being defended by Hispanic Catholics on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And it is.
Conquistador, crusader, 1488.
All those Groiper types. A lot of them are that, right?
Yeah, sir, your ideology is being defended by Miss Tizo Groiper Catholics on X.com.
One of the guys in my Discord, a Filipino guy, was making the joke that if you could actually have sex with aliens like Captain Kirk in about 1,000 years, you're going to have a 99% human who's gone completely atheist, and there's going to be some like arachnid with 8 limbs whose last name is Fernandez claiming that they're the true representative of white people in the Catholic Church.
Oh, God. I can believe it. I can believe the purest blood human being like, I am 100% arachnid. This is my alien heritage. You came and conquered our planet. You took our resources. And it's going to be the libtard who claims that you don't understand Starship Troopers because of media literacy.
Yeah, it's going to be the arachnid that claims human supremacy.
Well, you know what's funny? Isaac Young was actually on this year's Millennial. He was the one that, you know, he's a friend of mine. He was the one that started off the Starship Troopers media literacy bullshit. That was like insane during the summer. But yeah, media literacy. I guess in Canada, you do have. I think a lot of people they're going to be forced in the coming decades to really reconcile with what it means to be Canadian in general. I know people say that every generation, but I do think that there's a bunch of pressures currently that will force even normies to look at themselves and say, okay, what really does constitute us as a nation and as a people? And I think a lot of people are going to have to ask that, you know, very tough question, because it's from, you know, even before Justin, there was a sense that we kind of were like a sort of like postmodern, you know, post-national nowhere land. And that, you know, I mean, because of Americanization.
How's that turning out for us?
Yeah. No, go ahead. Yeah,
if I could shrink that a little bit, because I was thinking about what I was going to say on the stream. And one of the things that I see coming, I think that for the next 4 months, people are going to be very fractious, very full of anger and rage. Do you guys remember that Obama phone lady? When Obama got elected,
yeah,
you know, everybody in Cleveland, all minorities, got Obama phone. Well, I think that's going to be white conservatives, where they, like, we think, they think that by getting Trump in, that he's actually going to turn the ship around. And even if him, Elon Musk, RFK, if they do the best possible job, they roll Nat 20s the whole way, you're not getting rid of the inflation. You're not getting rid of, like, there's been, like, so many people have died for unknown reasons in the past couple of years that have really screwed a lot of things up. You've got, like, the immigration thing, it's going to be a slow turn of the ship. Yeah. Even if everything works out great, things are going to be ugly for the next 4 months, and people are going to be like a hair away from losing their minds. So I would, my suggestion is, keep your cards close to your chest, try and be building wealth as our dollars inflate away, and be frugal. Be frugal and try and be a sea of calm.
Invest in Palantir. Anger.
Yeah, get in bed with the PayPal mafia. That's a good strategy.
Yeah. With Musk, with Jeets, you win.
They have done more to red pill, I would say, people, or at least awaken people, than I think anyone expected in the States is the Indian question.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
The last few days, it's been amazing. I think a lot of people, because there was a lot of predictions you'd hear, oh, doesn't matter what Trump does, and this is Trump adjacent, all these guys, right? And he has basically endorsed what they're saying, that, oh, it doesn't matter what Trump does over the, you know, in this coming term, all the MAGA folk are just going to defend him to the bitter end. Doesn't matter what. Well, then all of a sudden the Indians came in.
You know, it's funny.
And they're like, I hate these people. I hate this whole thing. And I don't want them coming in massive numbers. This is ridiculous. And they're going, it's Trump's people they're doing this. It's Trump's people. It's not Harris. Harris would probably bring in more Mexicans, but not necessarily more Indians. You know, so it's
definitely been a big eye opener because I think.
How funny is it?
Yeah. Hold on a minute. One thing is that I think the triumphalism from the Indians on Twitter, I think, has disgusted a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And the question is, you've seen similar triumphalism from blacks, you know, like, yes, in 2020, you know, all of that. And yet that didn't disgust white liberals. But I think this from the Indians has.
But there's white guilt about the blacks, slavery, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And but we don't, and I we're not British in the States liberals or Canada.
Don't see blacks as their, I think also white liberals just don't see blacks as their equals. Whereas
yeah, there's that too.
Yeah,
but there is also that kind of historic guilt thing, which the Americans especially don't identify with the Raj that happened, you know, in India, blah, blah, blah. Oh, evil Brits, blah, blah. They're like, yeah, so what? In fact,
Americans don't even know what that is.
They don't know what it is.
They don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
And they might even agree with, yeah, actually, you Brits were pretty bad there. Meanwhile, we're amazing Americans. It's like, well, no, you had the slavery thing, so now you're guilty about that, you know. And we're in the state up in Canada, we're guilty about the residential schools. All the whites are guilty about something, right? But you know, so I think that's a lot to do with it, is that they're afraid about the blacks. Yeah, not their equal, but also the fact that they're afraid to say anything negative because slavery and Jim Crow laws and blah blah blah. Indians, who are these guys? These guys are weird. They're very different. They're not at all like us. And they're coming in, and they're not doing the lower-level jobs that the blacks tend to do either. But a lot of them are coming in as being the CEOs of our tech companies. So they can't really say that, you know, they're the downtrodden.
And it threatens the place of the social standing, yeah, of the liberal.
Yeah.
What I was going to say, it's funny how white Americans put up with 60 years of insane levels of crime, welfare usage from the blacks, and then also like the anti-white rhetoric from them. But then just the thought of having to live with Indians, well, that's what turns them racist.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Yeah, I think it's too far of a cultural gap. And I was also going to say, what's fascinating to see is that some of the, because like this is especially a big deal because the U.S., is a liberal nation at its core. It was founded on liberal republicanism of the American Revolution, taken from Edmund Burke and John Locke, like English liberal philosophers, right? But I'm seeing a lot of the American, including some of the MAGA guys now, are talking about how they're not a proposition nation. And this is very interesting because they are a proposition nation. At the very least, since 1750, when they made it for all white men, they opened it up to 63 nations of Europe, and there might have been decades where they limited it to certain parts of Europe, but eventually it would be the whole 63 nations of Europe, and you can kind of see this linear line, this sort of snowball that goes from including all Europeans to eventually the Hispanics to eventually the African Americans and now the Indians, right? So to see a lot of the Americans deny the propositionalism, the foundational liberal principles of their country, has been very fascinating. Like Charles Haywood is one of those people. But on that note, I would say that we as Canadians are in an extremely privileged position because we're not a liberal proposition nation and we never have been. The country was founded by two reactionary traditionalist groups, one rejecting the American Revolution and the other rejecting the French Revolution. And I would also say, and I wrote about this recently, that Canadians are so not liberal in their temperaments that they can't even do liberalism properly. We have the right to own firearms, barely, but we don't have the right to self-defense. We have the freedom of speech, but there's always a limitation. There's always a caveat. We technically have the right to own private property, except all of that can be taken away from you by the legal system, whereas in the States, that can't be, right? So even Canadians, when they adopt a liberal ideology, they don't make very good liberals. So and to top that off, the cherry on top to that is that because we skipped the whole classical liberal phase that the States went through in the 2010s, we can jump straight from left liberalism of the 60s onward to basically nationalism. And the benefit to Canadians is that they are made up of two homogenous ethnic groups, Anglo-Canadians and French-Canadians, whereas the United States has no shared ethnicity, and that is an important distinction.
Well, what I do like to see is that this argument that people just need to believe in Canadian values, that just really seems to fall flat because no one even knows what Canadian values are. What even are Canadian values? I mean, as far as I know, Canadian values, it's libtardism, which is what got us in this place.
And like,
multiculturalism, yeah.
It's just left liberalism. But here's the thing. The left liberalism of Canada under the Trudeau years is itself still very distinctly Canadian in its quality, not just because of the reasons I laid out, but because Trudeau's liberalism is itself a reaction to the perceived right liberalism of the United States. So even in the 60s, it is a fundamentally reactionary tendency, first to the American Revolution and now to the right liberalism of the States. We have developed a left liberalism to counter that.
Well, that's the problem, though. There was this, I believe it was funded by the National Film Corps Board, but there was this documentary back in like 2004 called Escape to Canada. And it was basically the thesis that, like, compared to Bush's America, Canada was sort of like this bastion of everything like libtards love, whether it be abortion, marijuana, multiculturalism, gay marriage. And I think like that idea has really soured in a lot of people, especially as those ideas have accelerated. And in a way, as Trudeau Jr. was in a way promised as sort of like a relief from Trump, if anything, he really has sort of crashed us into more of an accelerative American liberal political spectrum than even what you're talking about for it next. So I think that, you know, his father certainly helped break the door down, if you don't go by George Grant's thesis. But now it's like it seems that Trudeau kind of is like an American culture warrior, and a lot of like the libs in Canada, like Leaf Libs, are essentially like, you know, spiritual blue state Democrats. So there's a very like odd like loss of identity even among the political left. But another thing too is that you mentioned that about the civility and the sort of reactionary nature of Canadians. I said this back, and you'll really like this, Woz. I said this back when the protests were happening in England over the incredibly horrific murder of three young girls. the sort of like the civility, the legal doctrines, those very like, you know, stiff upper lip, those sort of mannerisms have that have sustained like, you know, Anglo people and, you know, people in Canada for generations. When you have like a very nefarious transnational progressive ideology that has spread throughout the body of the world, those values become something of a corrosive force rather than a sustaining or a nourishing force for a populace, because now they can be very easily weaponized against you. And I think you see this in Canada with this sort of what you would say, like the temperament of the average Canadian could very easily be switched to a negative, like atomization, for instance.
Yes. However, counterpoint, there's 3 points to that I would counter. Because of Canada's conservative foundations, because of its traditionalist foundations, it also means that our executive is much more powerful within Canada than the POTUS is in the United States. So just as easily as it was subverted, it could also just as easily be turned around. What's ironically protecting the American right now is their own checks and balances that are stopping them from decisively dealing with their problem. That's kind of the irony. And also, demographically speaking, they're the worst off in all of the Western countries.
Yeah, that's true. Like, for example, the First Amendment is really keeping them. But then, like you were saying, it's a catch-22 because they can't really do anything else besides survive. Yeah,
they would have to break the fundamentals of their liberal principles in order to decisively take out the left, and so they can't do that. So, in a twisted way, like, their poison was their medicine. Their, you know, their classical liberalism that doomed them is also stopping the left from totally destroying that nation.
Well, to quote Menkius Moldbug, he pointed out that the home of the digger wasp is also the home of the parasitic fungus that eats the digger wasp. And so radical leftism took a long time to take over the United States. But then you export it to somewhere like Canada, where it has no natural predators, and it very quickly went boom. And we saw the effects of it running rampant on its own. But it might be a case where how much more left can you go? It's now, you know, they're eating their own young to survive.
I think that Sweden is a good example that this can be turned around, because the Swedes, being somewhat culturally closer to the English in that their national value is order, and Canada's national value is also order, it's not liberty. POGG or POG is peace, order, and good government. Those are the foundational values that Canada was based on, not life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So Canadians value liberty, but not at the expense of order. Just as quickly as you saw Sweden turn around, and they're offering paid tickets. They're offering like 50, 60,000 kronor to re-migrate a bunch of those people. Like, I can see this as soon as the state ideology changes in Canada with the snap of the finger, and it becomes socially permissible to have many of these views, as it already is happening. It's not a day goes by without a video of some Canadian lashing out at a Jeet in public. As soon as that hits critical mass, you'll see an instantaneous shift, and a great many of those libtards are going to be like, oh, well, I was always anti-immigration.
That's an incredible light bulb for it next. Like, we're going to be the real base world, even more than America.
People don't understand that Canada was like considerably more conservative than the States for far longer. Like, abortion was illegal here far longer than it was in the U.S. The Mounties used to go door to door if they heard a woman was like trying to get an abortion or across the border to do that.
You know, it's a common theme throughout Canadian history that we've defined ourselves in opposition to the U.S. So the U.S. separated in their revolution. We stayed loyal to the crown, and we were more loyal to the crown than maybe even Britain, because that's kind of our way of defining ourselves in opposition to America. But today it's kind of we're more libtarded than America, because
America's still racist.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. It's the idea is that, well, America's still racist, so we have to be more anti-racist. Or, you know, you'll have some story coming out of Mississippi or something that some like evangelical private school didn't allow transgender kids into the bathroom. So then British Columbia has to like make it a point that they're going to have transgender bathrooms in every single public school just to have it over at this tiny little evangelical school in Mississippi or something. You know, my dream is that someday we're going to define ourselves in opposition to the U.S. by trying to outdo them by being more based than them.
And I actually predict that. I actually predict that happening, specifically because everything in the Canadian temperament is conservative and reactionary. Like, Canadians cannot escape that tendency. I would even argue that there was an evolutionary, almost reproductive selection pressure. I talked about this with Woes on my own millennial stream, where I was just like, look, like, 60,000 loyalists left the 13 colonies after being basically traumatized, killed, tarred and feathered. They had their property and assets seized by patriots. And so they marched north, very much like Aeneas and the Trojans, to Italy to refound civilization under the principles of Toryism, like actual pre-liberal classical conservative Toryism. And that's just the loyalists, right? Like they socially selected for order over liberty. And then in French Canada, it's the same thing. Quebec viewed itself as the last bastion of the ancien regime, just as the French Revolution was kicking off, until the 1960s, until the Quiet Revolution, when they all secularized. Quebecers literally viewed themselves as the last true French Catholic theocratic monarchy.
It was like a theocracy, yeah.
It was a literal theocracy for 400 years. Right. And like, you even see those authoritarian tendencies in Quebec even today, because even though the state ideology is now authoritarian social democracy and secularism, look at how insane their lockdowns were. They had the hardest lockdowns in all of North America. They had an 8 p.m. curfew that if you missed, you'd be fined $5,000 and up to $100,000 for other things COVID related. So like the orderly and the traditionalist tendencies in Canadians, even if the state ideology is left liberalism, is still there. And so I think the way forward is that, you know, Canadians also have the luxury of not being a proposition nation. Canadians are either Anglo-Canadian or Quebecois by majority. I've actually crunched the numbers. I've done the stats. We went through a reproductive selection pressure, and we went through an ethnogenesis into two major majoritarian ethnic groups on the continent. And so I think the way forward is to constantly counter signal American liberal propositionalism. We are in the position to counter signal the colorblind meritocracy that they keep pushing and actually out nationalist them. That's actually how it'll be done.
There's a growing, I have some insight as to what's happening with the people that enforce the government's dictates, which, as you said, it's actually a form of Toryism. So if you look at these legal atrocities that have been happening since COVID in Canada, it's actually out of radical loyalty to the status quo, to the system, to the traditional way. And yep. So we have these legal agents that are enforcing radicalism because they're extremely conservative. And mm-hmm. in their personal lives, in their psyches, this tension is beginning to reach a breaking point. So this is, I don't know how it's going to break exactly, but the people that are using guns and prisons to enforce radical leftism are having mental breakdowns because they don't believe in that radical leftism. They believe in adherence to order. And yes. They're using
yeah,
that
that's a great
for
point.
Chaos.
They're doing, like they're enforcing Trudeauian liberalism with the same tenacity that they would Toryism 300 years ago. Yeah. So even that is instinctively, no, I'm not even joking. They view the dissident right as upstart revolutionaries. They view them as threats to the traditional order, which has been the case since the post-war consensus, since the 60s.
Well, even like Trump, like spouting off of these jokes about Trudeau being like the governor of Canada, the 51st state, that really has like enraged libtards to the point where they are kind of like, in a weird way, there is like a hidden conceit of nationalism. But another example, and maybe this is kind of like ridiculous. Woes, did AA come on this year?
Unfortunately not. He isn't able to do streams in the evenings.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, there's this great, this was so long ago, this is like in 1998. There was this great rant by Brett the Hitman Hart. And, you know, I'm a lifelong wrestling fan. I don't know about you guys, but this was the weird thing about Bret Hart was that he was a heel in America. He was like, you know, a bad guy in America. And in Canada, of course, he was like a national icon. He's up there with like Wayne Gretzky and Terry Fox and so forth. So he had this rant, I believe it was in Madison Square Garden, where, and it's in the documentary, Hitman Heart Wrestling with Shadows, where he says, like, you know, in Canada, we respect each other, and we have healthcare, and we don't have gun violence, and we don't have racism, and our streets are clean. And it's like, and all the Americans were like going fucking nuts, right? They're like, boo. But I think, like, in a weird way, you could say, okay, those are the hallmarks of Canadian leftism. Like, we have better healthcare, we have better crime statistics, we have better this, better that, we have cleaner cities, which is all being, ironically enough, eroded away with the supremacy of the Trudeau regime. But in a weird way, like, to your point for next, like, you could almost hear, like, a form of reactionary conservatism in the sense yes. that Canadians are more wholesome. There's not, we're not as violent. We have a sort of like high Toryism preached to sort of like, you know, tariffs and healthcare system.
We have a sense of organic hierarchy and the concept of noblesse oblige has always been intrinsic to the Canadian soul. And I would argue, and I've made the case that Canadians are far more European than Americans are for this, because our ancestors took old world ideas and applied them in a new world setting. And Canada has long been regarded as the crossroads between the new world and the old. Like, well, it bleeds into
everything for it next. Like,
hold on, Gio. Oh, sorry, Mario, I was going to say, this reminds me of a video Irene made, which I think might have actually been the first one I ever saw. I think it was. And it was about Bane in the third Batman film. And the whole point there was that he was misleading the public, and so he wasn't a good exemplar. I mean, noblesse oblige came into that the upper class of Gotham had completely forgotten, been just corrupted, they'd completely forgotten their social duty towards everyone else in the city. I think this was also with the second film with the Joker, with the two boats. I can't remember what the setup was.
See, Batman is like the intro. To the extent I want to talk about cape shit, Superman is the idealized Democrat, where he's a free speech journalist. He speaks truth to power. He's an immigrant. He idealizes what it is to he comes to America to be the most American man that ever lived.
He's FDR.
While Bruce Wayne is old money, and when he puts on the costume, it's actually just him doing his duty as Bruce Wayne to defend his people in Gotham. And that Bane is the communist revolutionary that misleads everybody because the elites went astray.
Yeah. I don't think that the Nolan Batman films count as cape shit, do they? I mean,
I wouldn't personally, but yeah.
Well, Joker does it because it's a different thing.
Yeah, so sorry I interrupted you, Gio. When you, the mention of noblesse oblige reminded me of that. I wanted to
interject something. Everybody listening to this, we need to become that nobility. Okay? Like, if not us, our children. And what we should all be focusing on, more than politics. Okay? Because, like, politics... I've been watching a lot. All right, cape shit. I've been watching a lot of Star Wars. Okay, I've been getting back into it, and it's so interesting. The first Star Wars movie. Here's a big award show for you. You blew up the Death Star. You're the hero, Luke Skywalker. By the third movie, he's just having a conversation with his dad while the war is happening in the background. Because like the war of politics will always be there for the young men to go cut their teeth on. But what we all need to be doing is building up that power, building up that really firm base for us and for our progeny so that we can be the noblesse oblige.
Mm.
Oblige.
Oh, yeah. Oblige. Yeah, we need more leaders.
I was going to say to Fortnext's point, like that does bleed into everything. Like, for example, you know, like me being an artist, like all artists in Canada, you sort of like grow up in the shadow of the Group of Seven. And if you look at the originators, even before the official Group of Seven, you have, for example, in Hamilton, you have painters like William Blair Bruce, who actually went to France and trained under Monet. There's something markedly different when you look at a European Impressionist painting as opposed to the Canadian Group of Seven in terms of the landscape. Because in Canada, you have such a wide expanse of nature and such a sort of awareness of the ruggedness of nature. For example, Tom Thompson having to paint a whole row of trees in Algonquin just with a few simple brush strokes. Whereas in European Impressionism, there is an awareness of industry. There's an awareness of human activity, even like not even Impressionist painters, but for example, with Turner in Scotland and England, you have this, like, you know, the reminder of human activity is always around the corner. It's a kind of like a Heideggerian point where even the tree rows are very uniform, right? Like they've been enframed. Whereas in Canada, you had a response aesthetically to the nature of the Canadian landscape in North America. And so that came out very differently in a lot of ways in Canadian landscape painting, as opposed to the Impressionists in France and the Expressionists in Germany. So like that's everywhere. Yeah, it's everywhere.
Interesting.
I might need to sign off, guys, but it's been a pleasure. So thanks for having me.
Okay, you're welcome, and thank you, Endeavor, for taking part.
Talk to you guys later.
Bye.
I'm going to go for another 20 minutes before I head out. I got to get to Indentured Servant Lake by the end of the day.
Okay.
Well, Davis, before you go, I wanted to ask you something. Because, you know, I've been listening to you for many years as well, and, you know, I think we interacted here and there. I remember you read one of my tweet threads. It was like many moons ago. I think we're Facebook friends even. I wanted to ask you, because I interview people on my show, Content Minded, would you be willing to do like a sort of like online career retrospective with me, like the life and times of Davis Irini?
Oh, I'd absolutely love to, man. Absolutely. Fire me a message on X. I haven't been making a lot of content lately. Because, well, again, it's that thing is I don't want to be fighting useless fights.
Yeah.
And a lot of, like, we are constantly baited to be fighting useless fights. There are so many tweets, so many snarky little tweets I almost write. And right before I hit send, I'm like, nah, I'm deleting this. This isn't going to accomplish anything good, and it might cause me some trouble. And so it's... So I've slowed down in the content production, but I'm chewing on things a lot more and trying to think, like, what can I produce that would actually benefit the audience that I care about, you know, the people that pay attention, that read or watch my stuff, and like I want to do right by them. They don't need clickbait. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So no, I haven't quit. I've just been breathing in.
No, that's great because, like, I think that, you know, I think if we did something like more of a reflective mode, because you do have, like, a very fascinating online presence and, like, you know, you did inspire some of the greats. And I think a lot of people are sort of like, you know, that expression, like, my favorite band's favorite band that you don't know about? It's like
well,
that.
That's a great honor. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It's funny. I've been watching what's been happening. It's like we're having, I think this is the third Manosphere that's appearing, right? Especially with guys like Homath, who's fantastic. But I get the impression that he's not really aware of like the old MGTOW people or Roosh V or any of that stuff from 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And back when 10 years ago, when I was in the thick of it, occasionally I'd get some old dog that would mention, oh yeah, we were talking something similar back in the 90s. So it's like the third new Manosphere has appeared.
It's very irritating to see the Tates actually just basically take that, because that's what they did. Almost everything that there's, like, I have younger family members who are like, hey, did you check out this Tate video? I'm like, no, because everything that they're saying I checked out 10 years ago. Like, there's nothing new here. There's absolutely nothing.
I don't
want to
start fights, but it's like the high fructose corn syrup version of what we were talking about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Not a huge fan.
Ironically. Unironically.
No, it's all just scriptorism nowadays. There's no spirit to it.
Although the new Manosphere I'm talking about is actually good stuff, but for the most part, in my opinion. But yeah.
All right, let's get to some super chats, because there have been quite a few, and I've been neglecting them because the conversation was so just constantaneous. So,
we're not very German.
He's all from right. Israel. He can make up words if he wants.
It should be.
Canadians are starved for representation. They're starved for a voice, and I think that's why so much of this is exploding right now.
Mm. Oh yeah, we are at the forefront of a lot of various culture war issues. So, you know.
Yeah. Not to congratulate ourselves too much, but I think so. And I've been saying this for years, that it's only the dissident right that actually has an honest perspective on things. And that's not to say that we're perfect or whatever, but there's just so much that gets overlooked or neglected or denied, certainly by the left. I think on economic issues, they're usually correct. But they don't care about economic issues anymore. That's the whole fucking problem. They're obsessed with everything else. And on that, I think they're just roundly wrong on really everything. But anyway, obviously, I would say that. Okay, Enlightened Despot said, Justin Trudeau is Canada's longest-serving female prime minister. The man is the poster child of a matriarchy. I think that's an interesting phrase. It does occur to me, the same as, you know, someone likened him to Barack Obama, and I do think so, that he appeals to women's protective instincts because they see that other men don't like him. Other men think that he's, you know, faggy and whatever.
The bad man.
He's got the emotional maturity of a 15-year-old boy. Yeah. A very pretty little 15-year-old boy.
Yeah.
So what I would say to that,
long pretty man for a generation.
What I would say to that is that he's the king consort of the longhouse. Like, that's essentially what he is. He is the king consort to the grand mammy of what Bronze Age pervert would talk about as the longhouse. Like, he is that guy. He's not king. Oh, yeah. He's king consort. He's the spouse of the queen, of the grandmother queen of the longhouse that just holds down all of the young men. Right.
It's Remember he took his son to see Barbie, but he took his daughter to see Oppenheimer to make a point?
I got to point this out. The Barbie movie is about the end of feminism. The Barbie movie is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. It is so good.
No, listen, that's your lack of media literacy coming out, Davis. Like, you just don't understand Barbie.
The Barbie movie literally ends with Barbie in the realm of forms, the platonic realm of forms, talking to the dead ghost of her creator, who says patriarchy is just something we make up to feel better about ourselves. Barbie movie's great. Anybody that says it's a liberal movie, no, it's as close as you'll ever get to a woman saying sorry.
My favorite thing about Barbie is that women until basically 2 years ago had no idea that men liked Ryan Gosling, because the only reference to Ryan Gosling that they have is like chick flicks. Yeah, it's like rom-coms, it's chick flicks, it's Notebook, it's what's the other one? It's like just musicals, right? They have no idea that he is literally me. And that's that, right? And like, there's a whole generation of young guys who identify with his male roles that they have no idea.
Women didn't know about Believer.
I wonder why.
Well, they didn't know about Blade Runner 20. You know what I mean? Yeah. So,
all right, here's an amusing meme for that.
Oh no,
it's bad. I do not endorse as a wholesome Chungus women respecter.
I will say about Trudeau, getting back to him, and you know, everyone's dumping on him, but the ferryman who was on here a little while back did make an accurate assessment of things when he said, we make fun of him, but yet Trudeau would probably beat the crap out of just about every conservative guy out there.
I would love to take him on. Nothing would make me happier than being in the ring with that creep.
But so many people that attack him are not
the same height, and I outweigh him by 20 pounds.
Yeah, that's true.
So there you go. I'm not saying that nobody is. I'm just saying that he's a high percentage.
And Jagmeet, too. Jagmeet's like a black belt in BJJ.
Yeah, these guys are very fit guys. Yeah, sure.
Oh, he'd grab my dick.
All right.
You just know he's a dick twister.
We can dunk on BJJ and the superior martial art another time. That's a whole other schism in the on political discourse is the utility of BJJ.
All right. Darby says, Yankee go home, loyal I was born, loyal I will die.
Total, based.
Total Maple MAGA death.
Based.
Right. Okay, that's terminal. I'm not quite okay with.
We'll get into that in a bit, Gio. I can tell you about that.
All right. Okay.
And then Alt White says, best wishes to Canada. Thank you very much. And thank you to Darby. Post American says, red pill me on the Quebecois question. The
Quebecois.
Sorry.
That's a Fortis Axe question.
Mad Tabernacle, I speak Quebecois, Mad Tabernacle, the English Mad Tabernacle.
All right, sit down, Albertan. Come on now.
Sacre bleu, where's me mama?
All right. Yeah, look, you're from Ontario, Gio. You should know better.
No, I know. That was a Sopranos ref.
Yeah. All right, so red pill you on the Quebec question. Quebec nationalism is the only form of implicit white nationalism on the North American continent, because it's the only socially acceptable, with the exception of the indigenous tribes, it's the only socially acceptable form of nationalism, ethnic nationalism, in the Canadian psyche, as far as the Canadian Overton window is concerned. French Canada is based in reactionary. They rejected the French Revolution. They rejected the liberal propositionalism of Robespierre and the French Revolution. Until the 60s, they viewed themselves as the last bastion of the Bourbon monarchy. Matter of fact, many French-Canadian nationalists throughout the last 200 years have wrote and commented that they visited France and they were absolutely disgusted with the way that their country worked. You still even see a little bit of this today with their language. So obviously, France French and Quebec French have been influenced by English for many different reasons. Quebec being because they're right next to the Anglophones, and France because of the global dominance of American media. But what's interesting is that Quebec French is a preserved 400-year-old dialect of Norman and Court French, because 56% of the Quebecois last names, the majority of the French colonists were from Normandy. Normandy and secondary to that, Poitou, and then central France. So they're Quebecois French, like we knock it today. We say that mainly because of Joual, a working class dialect, was artificially, it was astroturfed by the communists in the 60s to become like the kind of main form of expression for Quebec French. But they used to speak normal French just with a Quebecois accent. So you even see this today, this like they're very, very proud in that one area of being the so-called true French, because they speak a 400-year-old dialect. There's an argument to be made too. American English is like a preserved form of English from like the 1700s. But so they were a Catholic theocratic monarchist society for 400 years, starting with Champlain. And they have inherent reactionary tendencies. And they managed to avoid and totally defeat the attempted demographic displacement from the colonial government by having an average of 5 children per family for 230 years. So they were already very low in number compared to the 13 colonies, back before the conquest of Quebec. And then after the conquest of Quebec, they implemented a policy called Les Revanches de Berceau, which means revenge of the cradles. And so they were like, okay, well, there's approximately 3 million British settlers coming to Upper Canada and New Brunswick. We're going to run out of any kind of influence or say in the nation if we don't keep up the birth rate. And they did. They had this existential instinct. They have this instinct to survive no matter the cost. And they managed to push through that. And so you have 5 children per family for 230 years. And so all of those instincts are still there. They're to this day, they're still the only province that for 50 years since the 1971 multiculturalism policy that has attempted to integrate foreigners. So Anglo-Canada has not had an assimilation or even an attempted assimilation policy for 50 years, for 5 decades. Quebec is the only one who has. And then in response to the 1988 Multiculturalism Act by Brian Mulroney and the Conservatives, Quebec forced the Quebec-Canada Accord onto the federal government, which gives them the unique power to control how many immigrants go to that province and which immigrants go to that province. So they're really the spirit of Canadian nationalism at this point. The spirit of Canadian nationalism on a heritage basis, on a traditionalist basis, is latent in the seeds of Quebec, and they're the only ones who fought for that. Some will say, well, what about Alberta? And it's true that Alberta, since the Reform Party, has kind of taken up the mantle of political conservatism, but not cultural conservatism, which is where you get a lot of American style liberal conservative ideas coming into Canadian conservatism through the CPC that way.
Yeoman farmer ideal, for example.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's because Alberta and the Western provinces received a wave or two of Anglo-American settlers from the Midwest who would constantly fight for cultural control and supremacy. The Anglo-Canadian character and the Anglo-American character of Alberta have been at odds basically since the founding of that province, represented by the figures of the Mountie and the Cowboy. They're like two polar opposites of the Anglo character. You have liberty and you have order. One of them is the cowboy in the name of the king's law. The other one is the very icon of liberty. So that's
the frontier idea in America.
The frontier, yeah. The liberal sort of independent yeoman frontier spirit. So that is the red pill on Quebec. They're inherently ultra-reactionary ethnic nationalists.
One thing I would really like to see is an alliance between Alberta and Quebec, because I think there's a huge shared interest, and yet there's this perception of enmity, which you elaborated why there's that perception of enmity, but I think there potentially is a way to ally that.
Yes, 100%. And here's the thing.
Yeah, I agree.
It actually happened before. The Reform Party, and what's weird is that Westerners don't remember this, or the ones that I've talked to, the Reform Party actually beat down the progressive conservatives by allying with Quebec nationalists for concessions of the federal government. That's how Reform slowly managed to diminish and then eventually absorb the progressive conservatives of Ontario. So that political alliance has existed before. And you now see with Danielle Smith, making moves like making English the sole official sole official language of the province of Alberta. You see them modeling their self-determination off of Quebec's instinctual behavior of asserting itself and its provincial interests. So there is a lot of room to grow for that alliance. And I also believe that with mass migration, there's an opportunity for Anglo-Canada and for French Canada once again to unite and stave off the foreign invader.
Well, the problem is that people talk about the Laurentian elite, which is true. I mean, they do have an antagonism towards Alberta. But, the Calgary elite, as embodied in the Canadian Conservative Party, like, there just is a problem with, like, a lot of, like, pathologies of, like, typically a stereotypical American Republican GOP bullshit. Yes. Like, for example, a lot of this was because of the National Post. As much as I love Conrad Black as a writer, I do think that, like, when Hollinger's owned the National Post, you have a lot of these, like, strange Americanized fixations in the Conservative Party and official conservative politics in Canada. Like, for example, the whole, like, fucking Israel Firster type of thing, like that, like,
yeah.
Extreme ultra Zionism was, like, never a thing in Canada before the mid 2000s.
That Christian kid, what's his name?
Calgary is the most corrupt city in Canada, the most corrupt major city in Canada.
There's that
Calgary's
there's
a problem.
That Christian kid from Alberta, what's his name? He wears like the MAGA hat and everything. He's like a good example of that.
Tyler Russell?
Yeah, maybe. He was like a high school kid or something who got expelled for something to do with faith and COVID. I can't remember. I'm not talking about Pastor Pulaski. Yeah. I'm not talking about him. He's some other guy. But I would say that, and also the biggest pro-annexation proponents are like a cohort of that Western spirit. The biggest liberal Republican sort of American conservative proponents of annexation are from that part of the country.
I just got a brief comment on that. The idea of Canada being annexed by the United States is like a person with syphilis and a person with HIV AIDS. Deciding to have unprotected sex.
Well, that's it. That's it, right? So, and like, they don't get it. And what was absolutely blackpilling to me about the PPC, for example, among a great many things to blackpill over with the PPC, in the poll that had been conducted, like 55% of PPC supporters were in favor of annexation. I'm like, you guys are, you're liberals. You're Republican liberal propositionalists. You have no sense of ethnic identity or heritage. You have no sense of
the... It's a tempting edgy boy opinion. It's a tempting edgy boy opinion.
Well, it's a survival tactic for them because they figure Trudeau's never going to go away, so might as well hitch on.
Yeah, and look, I get it. I harp on them a lot. Look, the reality is that a lot of people are starving not just, I don't just mean for food. I mean for like basic life opportunities. Like Canada has the lowest upwards mobility in the G20, in the OECD for young people. So like this place ain't it. We're very quickly slipping into Argentina. So I don't blame a lot of people for wanting to go that route. But like it's a mix of the Trudeau's left liberalism mind wiping the country, and then the export of American influence into Canada that is fueling that.
Will PPBR Malay then, or no?
What's that?
Well, you said we're turning into like Argentina. Will PP be like our Malay or no?
No, I don't think so. Malay? I don't even know if it's possible for Polyev to like even stem the tide, to be honest with you. Like,
yeah, true.
Like it's
he agrees I've with zero 90% of things anyways.
Well, that's it, right?
The only thing I would like for the only reason I'd vote for Conservative next year is because he probably would get rid of the harms bill. That'd be pretty much it. Nah, probably not even. I don't know. Like,
he might bring a watered down version of it instead. That's what a lot of people are afraid of.
Like, you know, but his watered down version will be like, I'm not going to go after right wingers, but I will go after anti-Semite. It's like he even said that recently.
Yeah.
You know, which is a very American.
He's a Shabbos boy from the prairies. Isn't that what he said?
He's literally verbatim. He's just a simple goy from the prairies.
Simple goy from the prairies. That's what it was. Yeah. It's wow.
Really?
That was nosy.
So listen, he's a simple goy from the prairies, and we're going to have direct flights to Amritsar.
No, but I think like his strategy and Woz, you would know about this, like a lot of European like Eurozone politicians like Geert Wilders, they will play up like the Zionism because their like ulterior motive is to have a moratorium on Muslim immigration. So, but I think in Canada, like that issue's different. It's like cargo culting American politics.
Yeah, so, I don't think that Canadian political elites are savvy enough to even conceive of a play like that. I can see that happening in Europe. And I wrote about this recently too. What's nauseating is hearing parties like Reform in the UK, like Farage, talk about how the UK is a melting pot, or like Naomi Seid, who is like the Eva Vlaardingabroke ripoff from Germany, saying like Germany is a melting, like, no, I hate to break it to you. You are not a melting pot. And it's clear that they're trying to ingratiate themselves with the elite shift in the United States. And it's like, no, I don't want global America. This is very quickly becoming another form of globalism. This is like right-wing globalism. Yeah. It's the reconsolidation
of
the American empire.
My swap is based globalism.
Yeah.
We're going to have riot cookbooks. So we're going to have like, you know, yeah, like my swap is based globalism.
We're all going to have the First and Second Amendment and constitutional rights and freedoms. And everyone is an individual with no heritage. And everyone can be a Canadian or a German or a Brit.
Everybody can work for the corporation.
Yeah. And it's just
but don't
like,
you know Muslims are based because they're like traditionalist or something? That'll be the next argument.
Man,
in Europe.
They're natural conservatives.
No, Farage even said that. Remember, he said well, we can't alienate the Muslims because they are natural conservatives. So
you know what the ethnic violence in Canada thus far has primarily been intra-racial. So we had this giant riot of one group of black people against another group of black people, a whole bunch of machetes flying around, 5 dead bodies, I think.
Oh, and
yeah. But it wasn't so Canadians, like what you were saying about the Islamic violence in Europe is palpable. But here, thus far, they've been keeping to their own for the most part. So it's, it's less of a problem yet.
Well, they still Palestine thing, but that's different. You know, that's
so. Yeah. I mean, like on my priority list of dangerous demographics in Canada, like Muslims are closer to the bottom because they're not anywhere near the population density or total numbers. Like if you look at subcontinentals, it's something like 7 or 10% of the entire national population now is just subcontinentals. And the other thing too with the Muslims is that they're primarily concentrated in Montreal, and that's because Quebec selects for French-speaking colonial immigrants. They select for North Africans from Algeria and Tunisia and Lebanon, rather than the ones that come from Anglo colonies. So like the 2 million man march for like Palestine, which was orchestrated by a pro-Palestinian NGO in Montreal, like that's the only place in Canada where that could have happened.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of Lebanese in Montreal. Like there's that famous movie, Incendiaries, I think it's called, Incendiaries, right? It's about like that, about the Lebanese Civil War, but they were like a family in Canada. And like a lot of Adam McGowan films have a lot of like Lebanese people, as well as Armenians, of course, because, you know, Adam McGowan, you know, famous Armenian director. That's like, to me, like that's an unexplored side artistically of Canada, is that there is like a lot of like a lot of Canadian indie films and artwork. They do have this like forlorn sense of longing and sort of like placelessness, which comes up in like basically all of Adam McGowan's films. And I think like that's like there's something about that type of filmmaking that's very unique. Like people talk about like, for example, like even Canadian indie rock, like people can, or alt rock back in the 90s, like people could like hear like a band was from Canada, you know, like there was something to it. I don't know. Yeah.
They're so hip, it's a tragedy.
Yeah.
All right. I want to play something. It just occurred to me while you were all talking there that, and this is a complete change of topic, so it's very abrupt and clumsy. I'm sorry. But maybe you can help me with this. For me, Zoomers are a foreign species, but they seem to have their own lingo in a way that just wasn't the case with my generation 20 years ago. So here is a Canadian Zoomer.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
It's a short 22-second clip, right? But it's fucking agony to watch.
I bet it's the Toronto accent.
Yeah, the Toronto accent, yeah.
It is indeed. Here we go. Here we go.
What's the worst place in the GTA?
Fam, fucking Mississauga. My word, Mississauga, you're gonna get your fucking death falls when I see them. Holy, those youths are fucking goofy. Goofy Saga youths, you live in a fucking gray ass. Your shit look like, oh, nah. Mississauga for dumb youths, for dead youths. My word.
Yo, broski, so like Jano's guy. So I was talking to these like mandem. These weight suits walking around with their pink hair. So,
am I right in thinking that this is a middle class tit?
Yes and no.
Yes, working class.
Yes and no. So I'll explain what this is. So for a very long time, you got a lot of Nigerians who speak pidgin. A lot of British people accusing Canadians of copying their accent. But what's actually going on is that Jamaicans, being in the Commonwealth, actually migrated to both Canada and Britain. So they brought with them their slang and their mannerisms. Except mm-hmm. in Toronto, this mixed with Ontarian hockey slang, and then like East Indian, usually, and East Indian and West Indian, like from Trinidad, another Caribbean nation. So that accent is the culmination of Jamaican, Trinidadian, East Indian, and Arabic. So they'll be like
the equivalent is the Toronto equivalent of what happens in London. Where
yeah, I was going to say that.
Yeah.
London English, which is just now, awful. Awful.
There's some context here which is important. 90% of Torontonians do not talk like this. A very small.
It's like a mixed breed diuretic dog.
Yeah, and. So 90% of Torontonians don't talk like this. Most of the youth do not talk like this. Maybe about 10% of them do, and it is a natural accent for them, but the rest of the youth are copying them. That's where it's
There's hockey slang.
So it's like a gay kid talking with a lisp for 6 months.
No, but they mix it with hockey slang, so they'll say like, you know, oh yeah, going around the Michigan, you know, like.
Oh, dude, it's abysmal, man. Like, it's the worst thing I've ever heard. But I was actually...
And is it correct about the architecture of Mississauga? Is it for dumb utes? Are they going to get a deaf as and so forth?
Yeah, Mississauga is like the worst parts of Toronto with none of the benefits. Yeah.
So this is not normal Canadian Zoomer speak. This is like specifically inner city, like working class Torontonians who are copying foreigners.
You know what it reminds me of? Like what was you were saying? It reminds me of those like black kids in England that will talk like with a half American slang. Like, who's that rapper that Morgoth got really big on and going after? Stormzy. What's his name? Stormzy.
Stormzy.
Yeah, Stormzy. It's like the same. Yeah.
Another thing too is that there's a lot of East, like Indo. I don't even like calling them Canadians, but like Indo Canadians who are first or second gen descendants of East Indian immigrants. they also default to this, like, you see this a lot on the West Coast, this like ghetto, like pseudo black East Indian accent. And it has like, you know, like guy, like it has like the ups and downs guy. It's got like the up and down thing. And like, it's insufferable, man. And like a lot of the ethnic Canadian youth copy this as well. Like a lot of the Anglo-Canadian.
The thing is, though, this is so dangerous because they copy it, but then eventually, like 5 years later, it will be natural to them. They won't be copying it anymore.
Oh, yeah.
This is how it happens.
And it's not just the dialect, but also the values.
That word goof is specifically prison slang.
Yes, that's wholly Canadian.
I hate
Western Canadian prison slang.
I hate that word. Anybody that says goof in their common vernacular, I immediately, like, you know, just go get arrested again. I don't want to talk to you.
So that is very specifically Canadian prison slang. So anyone who says that is either from prison or they're like prison adjacent. They grew up with a parent.
Prison adjacent. If somebody calls you a goof in prison, you either fight them or you get raped later that night.
It's okay, so that's what goof means.
This kid has never been anywhere near a prison.
Oh, probably not.
But I don't know. I'm not okay with it.
It's like the equivalent of saying punk or prag in an American prison. Yeah.
I'll just play it one more time.
What's the worst place in the GTA? Fam, fucking Mississauga. My word, Mississauga, you're going to get your fucking death rolls when I see them. Holy, those youths are fucking goofy. Goofy Saga youths, you live in a fucking gray ass. Your shit look like, oh, nah. Mississauga for dumb youths, for dead youths. My word.
Pain, agony, I mean, even malice.
We're not seeing the full version, which, you know, he might have been very articulate for all.
Yes, I'm sure.
My mother is Scottish Toronto, and my mother uses words like cross. It made me very cross.
Yes.
My word is elite Scottish Torontonian. So that it's like, what an ugly little bastard mix of language that.
Yeah. Oh, it really is.
It is. And you know what's funny too is that internationally speaking, among all of the nons in Britain, in Europe, in the United States, they hate the Toronto accent. They hate it. They clown on it. African Americans clown on the Toronto accent constantly. They're like, this is a joke. This is only because Drake went to the UK and brought back all the mannerisms. And it's actually totally homegrown in the sense that it's a convergence of immigrant diaspora to the GTA. But they hate it. It's hated in LA. And it's funny because, like, Toronto is an alpha world city. It's like the fifth or sixth largest city in North America. So it's up there with like Toronto and Los Angeles. And so you get a lot of artists coming out of musicians, rappers coming out of Toronto. And so they rub shoulders with a lot of these Americans in Los Angeles and New York. And like, they just hate it. They detest Toronto. They detest every and all immigrant diaspora who made it in the big leagues in American media that have come out of that place.
Yeah, fuck. It just needs to be this needs to be throttled.
You know, as soon as the last three good men leave Toronto, God will smite it.
everybody in the West hates Toronto too. It's just like,
yeah it's
automatic.
Montrealer, like, look, I'm a Montrealer.
Every Niagara hates Toronto.
I'm a Montrealer. I instinctively hate Toronto. I hate the Leafs.
And you always hate Bay Street, at least the Westerners.
Yeah. I am mandated by blood like to hate Street. GTA.
Yeah.
You know what's funny? As much as I hate Toronto, I am kind of like a ride or die Leafs fan.
I didn't think to do that, so I'm sorry. That would have been a good idea. All right, let's move on to another super chat because time is going. So this is Enlightened Despot, and he says, there is only one issue in Canada. Who watches the CFL after the Edmonton Eskimos became the Edmonton Elks?
What?
Okay.
I think this is probably the politically correct renaming of a
Yeah, because they didn't want to offend the Inuit, because Eskimos was a misunderstanding by the Europeans, because it just meant like meat eater or something like that, I believe. And so they really were supposed to be Inuit. But of course, why are a bunch of whites and more often blacks going around on a team with the name Eskimos? So, you know, it's highly, highly offensive. And we got
mangeur de la viande crude.
You know, I mean, this happens all over the place in the States too, right? You got to change the names because it's offending the local tribe. Most of whom are like, we don't care.
We really don't.
Yeah. We're ashamed of our history. Stop referencing it.
Yeah, there was a sports team recently that I can't remember. Someone in the chat will remember, but it was in, might have been Detroit. Anyway, okay, Enlightened Despot also said, the Iroquois waited for the plague to hit the Hurons, then in their infinite native mercy, wiped them out. 400 made it to Quebec.
Yes.
Yep. Sounds about right.
Yeah, this is the raid in the 1640s, where they had something like 1,000 warriors, 300 of which had arquebuses and cannons. And this is when they made their push into southern Ontario against the Huron, and they completely smashed, like, the Huron were wiped out of local, like, geopolitics forever, basically, from that attack.
A lot of these tribes, we just know them because of their names, but the tribes don't exist anymore, or they're very small numbers. Of course, the European gets blamed. You know, Americans are going around killing all the Indians, Red Indians, you know, back after, you know, the American Civil War, all that kind of stuff. But really, there's a lot more to it than that, and there's a lot of intertribal warfare.
No, it's true. We talked about, like, because you talk about, you know, you can't win no matter what the thing is. So even if you get them to acknowledge that what they did was enact genocide on at least 9 or 10 tribes in their vicinity, mm-hmm. they're going to blame the white man for giving them the guns and the cannons.
Oh, yeah.
And I've heard that. I've heard it. They're like, well, who gave us the guns? It's like, dude.
And also the whiskey. Don't forget the whiskey.
Yeah. No, it's funny. Fire my water. Old man did this, actually. In our town, they were doing some, like, land acknowledgement thing. But then he wrote this letter to the editor in their local paper. And he's like, no, you know, like, there was a pre-existing tribe that this Iroquois-affiliated tribe basically genocided. And they had to, like, print the retraction and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
So some in the live chat have it's the Washington Redskins and the Cleveland Indians. I think it was the Redskins that I was.
Yeah, the Redskins, they changed that. And all the natives are like, we don't care. We actually liked it because then we got to be the good guys because we're the winning team, the Redskins. Now it's like, I can't even remember what they changed it to. I stopped following all that a long time ago. But it's just like, you know.
The stuff like that's been going on for ages. I can remember.
Yeah.
I want to add some context too, just before we move on to the next topic, because I think you guys will find this interesting. So what actually prompted the Iroquois to do all of this was because the French settlements in Quebec were it formed earlier than the English ones. And the French had already started trading with the Huron and the Algonquins. So all of the northern tribes who were traditionally enemies of the Iroquois, but they wouldn't give them guns. What they did instead give them was iron arrowheads and tools and axes and hatchets and stuff like this, occasionally sword blades to make into spears. So what started happening was you had this ceremonial warfare between all of them. They were basically skirmishes. They had not yet been introduced to the concept of total war. So you get like warriors on both sides of a river, or sometimes in an open field, there'd be like 25 to 30 of them, and they would taunt each other, they would insult each other, they would shoot each other with arrows. Occasionally there would be fatalities, but most of it was ceremonial. It was about humiliating the enemy and scaring them into not attacking. And there was a principle of retaliation here. There was vengeance. There was eye for an eye. So if you killed like 5 of them, they would have to return the favor. And what threw a wrench into this was the Huron and the Algonquin started attacking them with iron arrowheads and iron axes, to the point where these tribes in southern Ontario started forgetting Neolithic recipes for their crafting. They forgot how to make stone arrowheads. They started forgetting how to make their traditional tools. And so the iron arrowheads started piercing the wooden armor of the Iroquois. And then Champlain charges a war band of 300 on Lake Champlain, literally on the shores of Lake Champlain, where Vermont is today. He opens fire and he kills 2 Iroquois chiefs with a single shot of his musket or with his arquebus. And they realized, oh, there's an arm race. They have more technology. They have superior technology. So in order to lock down access to guns and cannons, they started wiping out all of their regional tribes to limit access to guns from the English and the Dutch. And this is how they got their hands on guns. And the first thing they did was wipe out everybody in their vicinity because they had overhunted the beaver and other animals for pelts in New York State, which is where they come from. So that's what started that spiral. And you'd think that a society that was introduced to higher technology would abandon some of its older ritualistic ways. They did not. The typical, they call this, the anthropologists in Canada used to call this the cannibalism torture sacrifice complex, which was this process where they would make people run through a gauntlet. They'd beat them. They would torture them. Champlain writes about this extensively. They would like disembowel people. They'd wrap their entrails around their heads. They'd decapitate them. They put their heads on pikes on front of their palisades. They would eat hearts. They would eat hearts of the newly dead. So you'd think that with a lot of the advanced technology, the Iroquois would have dropped a lot of this. No, they did what the Aztecs did. They actually doubled down on a lot of those on their conquests. So they started doing this even more with guns and cannons. And that's actually what led to their ascension. They consolidated their power so much that for 200 years, the British settlers and the 13 colonists were contending with this Iroquois regional power up until about 1750. And they were powerful enough to have somewhat of a say in the U.S. Constitution. The Iroquois have a few things in there that they're responsible for. So,
to which libtards love that little factoid.
Yes, yeah. But the reason they did that and they were able to do that is because they just wiped out everybody in the vicinity with modern technology.
That was even in the film. I remember we watched in school. Of course, that they'd never air in school now. What was it called? The Black Robe?
Yeah.
Well, that's depressing.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. It's just gross.
Well, it's like Dark Age warfare. People don't understand this. Like Champlain and the early colonists were fighting hand to hand with these people. The arquebuses were extremely unreliable. Like they were matchlock rifles. They had a piece of string that was lit on fire, and you hoped that when you pulled the trigger, that would hit the pan and then fire the charge out, right? But arquebuses, not only were they unreliable, most of the colonists the French colonists and the British did not initially have them in droves. So they were fighting the indigenous with halberds. They were fighting them with side swords and bucklers. They were fighting them hand to hand, like Dark Age style. Like Champlain actually killed a mutineer in 1608 and decapitated him and put his head on a spike in front of the fort in Quebec City. So like a lot of crazy stuff happened that would make for an incredible TV series or for movies or for like, you know, consolidating and for glorifying Canada's masculine warrior heritage. Like we're sitting on a gold mine of our own Cortez. You know what I mean? Based on that, on all of that craziness that happened. So
yeah, we could have like a Werner Herzog style, like what's that called, Aquira, the Wrath of God.
Yeah,
it could be like that, yeah. In North America. Yeah.
No, but for real. So I call this era Primordial Canada because like between like 1530 to like 1660, it was this very obscure period, sort of, you know, shrouded by fog, where you have warrior conquerors and cartographers like Champlain. You know, and the earliest colonists fighting hand to hand against these like Neolithic tribes, right? Like it's just incredible stuff.
Well, that's the thing, is that to a great extent, until relatively recently, the military technology of the European wasn't that massively advanced relative to them. So often they were at best even. And if their numbers were much smaller, it was very difficult. That's why they had, you know, when they did have a few firearms, they hoped they worked and didn't blow up on them or whatever. You know, that was the only way they could have any victory. I mean, even there's a book that came out, I think about 25 years ago, written by a New Zealand guy, of all things, about Canada's Western tribes. And when the British first came, they were very, very careful how they handled things. This was like 1780s, thereabouts, when Captain Vancouver and so forth came. And when the tribes here on the West Coast came, they came in multiple boats, armed to the teeth, ready for war. And the British didn't just open fire like, ha, we'll just blow you out of the water. They were like, no. We're going to be careful because we're a pretty small number. And we know that our cannons and our muskets aren't always going to be dependable. We can't always depend on them to fire rate or, you know, that kind of thing. And besides, it takes forever to reload them. So they were very careful in how they handle things. And in this book called Contact, he said they were very much about negotiation, which is one of the reasons why out here in British Columbia, there were no treaties. Like there's only been very recently, like in the last few decades, have treaties been negotiated and written and signed for by both sides, because it was just kind of a, we're just going to be very careful how we handle you. We're not going to have war and then sign treaties. We're just going to try to, you know, dance around, do this dance to avoid having full on contact war, because we would lose. We would almost certainly lose. The British would not win.
I think Alaric the Barbarian had a really good series of threads where he was like, actually, like, Cortez is even more incredible because those 500 conquistadors, yeah, they had guns. They weren't very good. And they mostly fought hand to hand. Like, they were wearing almost full plate mail. Mm-hmm. They're wearing like iron and or steel breastplates and greaves. They were, you know, and swords like Spanish espada de lados. They weren't using like Victorian style volleys with like the single shot cartridges that you see in movies, like Rourke's Drift or anything. Those are way more advanced. Like, people think that that's how colonial warfare was. Like, no, most people got their first shot off and then they switched to hand to hand almost immediately.
Cause you didn't have time. It took you what? 30, 40 seconds at least to reload.
If you were an extremely skilled gun person, and you'd be able to reload in like 20-ish seconds. And like, that's like the best of the best.
And that's an eternity when someone's charging at you with a sharp, you know, weapon. So, or has an arrow trained on you or whatever. Right. So
I'm going to get ahead in, but I just want to leave you with one little bit of trivia that I believe the last time that a sword was deployed in an armed conflict effectively was around 1970. So study the blade, fellows. Thank you so much for having me. I got to get out of here.
Okay.
You guys have a great night.
Take it easy, Davis. God bless.
Cheers.
See ya.
You too. And happy new year, everybody.
Yeah, you too.
You too.
Yeah, it really did change when firearms, you know, when rifling and everything came in by the middle of the 19th century. That was the, you know, the game changer. After that, there was no way these tribes would have a hope, you know, once you get more and more automated, you know, you had industrialized firearms being made, you know, just
by the time of the machine gun, by the machine gun, it was over.
Yeah. Yeah. When you had the Gatling guns.
It's a mall you made and he was like crucified for it.
No, but I mean, it's true. And the thing too is, at least for the Northeastern tribes, the reason they held out so long is because they modernized their military. Like I said, the Iroquois had wholesale regimented warfare. They were not, you know, they went from Neolithic weaponry to guerrilla weaponry that you see in like Last of the Mohicans. People think that that's how the indigenous fought with guns. They didn't. That was only a short period of time. Wholesale, eventually, we're talking line infantry. We're talking a guy leading like line infantry and then like cannon artillery on the sides of the battlefield. Like, that's actually how they did it. So,
all right. Let's move on. by the way, someone's just said, Stephen said, can't tell which one it is because you're in mini player while I'm doing stuff around the house. But is it just me or does Orini kind of sound like Dave the Distributist?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
I guess.
I wouldn't
there, there was a joke I remember a few years ago where like all those YouTubers kind of sound similar, like Prude sounds similar to Endeavor, Endeavor sounds similar to Distributist, but like Arini originated that voice, you know, so yeah.
And then there was another one. Bar Downey says, wherever you are, tell me what towns are for us. Buy them. Businesses, farms, and homes too. Even the local Timmies. So that's a call to action. And I think this is a very good idea. We've been talking about it on Millennial. Several different people are doing projects like this, are involved in that. So I think it is an excellent idea. And we're probably going to need them in the future. So very good. Mark Hansen made a very generous super chat and said, thanks for all you do, Woz. Thank you very much, Mark. And GB Mac said early on, waiting for Fortisax to send it. I don't know what he's referring to there.
That's Canadian slang.
Oh, all right.
At least I assume that's what he means. Full send is an Albertan thing. They'll say like full send on, etc.
Right, okay.
Waiting for Fortisax to call to action, I think.
Okay. Kevin said, Pierre was adopted and his adopted dad later came out as gay.
not a good sign.
Yeah, he's actually Irish. Pierre is, that is. Pierre Poilievre.
I thought he was Cuban.
No, that's Justin.
I've never heard that. I heard it was Irish heritage.
Oh, but, that's Justin. Yeah, that's Justin.
Yes. Yeah.
Castro Trudeau.
But I did know he was adopted by French Canadians. I think they're from Ontario, and then they moved to Alberta or something like that.
He's Poilievre is Francois, so he's French Saskatchewan.
Oh, Saskatchewan. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Darby said, question for the panel. Is it based or cringe that His Next Majesty's government will have the official opposition be the Quebec Separatist Party? That's probably the most nationalistic party in Canada.
Meh.
Part of coalitions, first time in 30 years, they'll be in the role of opposition.
So this is both based and cringe. It's based because they will probably pressure the federal government on immigration because they're extremely against immigration. Cringe because they may try to stop Poilievre reducing gun laws.
Yeah.
They're generally pretty liberal.
Yeah, it's like Sinn Féin in Ireland.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You can't really trust them.
The instinct is there, but it's manifested poorly.
Yeah.
Well, some people in Ireland, I know because like my GF is Irish, like people they don't trust, like Gerry Adams, for instance, because he wasn't like taken out by the British at the time. So it's sort of like kind of sus, you know what I mean? Yeah.
All right. And then there was a good question here from Kevin, arguing that natives should adopt. This is when we were talking about the residential schools. Arguing that natives should adopt our languages is entirely the wrong approach to this. It is cultural destruction that weakens a people. If Germans lose their language, is that a good thing to keep up with the modern world? It's like Elon logic. So I've left this one to the end because I think there's quite a lot to say about it.
So the question of assimilating the indigenous has propped up basically since the very beginning of the country. The residential school, the institution of the residential schools, to my knowledge, was the Liberal Party's attempt at actually assimilating them. I think that most of them ended up being assimilated indirectly anyway, because the vast majority of them speak English or French. They don't remember their indigenous languages. They've already suffered from a massive cultural dispossession. I have an interesting perspective in that I actually don't like Pierre. Here's another thing. Pierre Trudeau tried to assimilate them. Pierre Trudeau wanted to end the Indian Act and like force them to integrate into Canadian society. He wanted to end the reservation systems. He wanted to forcibly make them Canadians. But this didn't end up panning out, especially because of the 1971 Multiculturalism Act. So I'm actually in favor of giving them more autonomy, but from the benevolent caveat that we have the right to intervene at any point. So I would be fine with them having as close to as much autonomy as possible within the reservations. You want your own cops, you want your own firefighters, you want your own languages, go for it.
But not funded by us.
but not funded by us.
Everything is.
And I think that this is the way to meet them as nationalists. I think this is the way to meet them is to meet them eye to eye and be like, look, you've got your identity. We're not going nowhere, but so are you. So like here's your space. We're going to leave you alone. Anything goes in your territory. We're not cleaning up your mess. And
it's a great irony, too, that we still have the Indian Act, which is a Victorian era act that has not been changed since that time, fundamentally, no matter even when there's been some hints of change happening. Doesn't matter how liberal you are, how much you're in favor of whether or not you're for individualism or if you're for this kind of libtard kind of view of things. It doesn't matter. We are still living with this white man's burden mentality of we as the white man are going to oversee you. And it's kind of funny, you know, that nobody has taken any great effort to change that. And a lot of it's because the natives themselves don't want to change because it's a great grift,
especially for the
chiefs. They get so much out of it. So they don't really want to change it. They'll make noise about how terrible it is and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's so paternalistic, blah, blah, blah. And then if you ever hint at doing anything fundamental to change it, like really seriously change it, they're out in full protest.
And that's the irony, right? It's like it's again the situation of like you, no matter what you do, you lose. It's like you go totally hands off and you give them as much self-determination as possible. Well, now you're not investing in them and now you're not respecting them and paying attention to them or doing things for them. But if you do intervene, well, it's, you know, it's everything, right? So I think like just as much independence as realistically possible on a legal basis and just let them do their thing.
I generally agree with that super chatter. Yeah, the destruction of language is obviously an anti-nationalist position, but to Fortnite's point, there was recently this like very insane string of statements by, I believe, an NDP woman politician who talked about like indigenous law and oral traditions should be like the law for everybody in Canada, and that it's like whatever they say goes. Like I have the National Post article, but I wanted to do a Core Report episode on it. But it was like this very insane like insinuation, but in a weird way, it was like a perversion of, I guess you could say, like traditionalist, or in America, what do they call it? The originalist position of the Constitution, but only retroactively applied to Indigenous people, that like everybody in Canada should be subject to it. But yet it's like, okay, we're a multicultural country, but it's like Indigenous law should be applied to everybody. It was a very strange, like, you know, libtard virtue signaling type of thing.
Yeah, there's a really like I've watched a number of fights between Indigenous activists and like wholesale libtards before.
Yeah.
Because the Indigenous activists go full blood and soil. They're like, no, this is actually our land and you don't have the right to live on it. And they're like, okay, well, anti-colonial racism is still racism and you can't do that. And it was a very interesting exchange to see. They're like wholesale, we have blood quantum laws. You need to be purely Indigenous. We're the only true legal inheritors to the land. And it's like, if you were in any other context, you'd be right wing. You'd be like,
that's an ironic you would Fanon believe too in Africa. Yeah.
They virtually do have like a one drop rule with a lot of the natives. They're like, if you're mixed, you know, Métis or whatever, you know, any of these kind of mixed people, they kind of look at you and go, you're not really one of us. Doesn't matter if the law says you're not really fully one of us. Yeah, but like you said, if anyone else did, like especially if white people did that, it's like, whoa, you know, you're going to court, you're lose your job, all the rest of it. But they can get away with it because they're a special group. I just one quick point also related to that question or that was given to us. The whole concept of the reserves was intended in its own way to preserve their culture, to preserve their languages, but the tribal people would leave and go to the white man consistently, like the residential schools. They would go there, high percentage, not all of them. A lot of them stayed home. They'd go to the cities. Why? Because there was money there, right? There was jobs if they worked. If they didn't work, there was at least food handed out to them by the white man. So, you know, what do? They learned English. They learned French. That's what would happen. So there was an intention to try to separate them and allow them to have their land, their culture, and their language, but they would still migrate towards the Europeans. So it's more complicated, obviously, but a lot of that's what it is. So
yeah, it's the inevitability of resources and where they are, right, in that sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm in favor of basically just benevolent independence. Just like, here, you can do your own thing. You have as much independence as you want, although under the caveat that we can intervene at any time. But like, we're going to leave you alone.
Yeah, they start massacring each other and that kind of thing. Which they...
No, literally, I would grant them a very significant degree of autonomy.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
It's a difficult question because...
It is.
These are questions that are matters that arise from centuries ago when there was a completely different paradigm, and like white people were thinking in a completely different way from the way we now think. So these problems emerge into our consciousness today, and it's rather difficult for us because, and I don't mean like anyone on this panel, I just mean white people in general. I mean, how do you deal with the fact that it's like that thing that, well, okay, it's stolen land, so are you going to sell your house and give it to them?
No, of course not.
You know, well, no, and obviously, obviously they, like, I mean, some of them expect Europeans to move en masse back to Europe, but this is obviously not, obviously not realistic. But are 27 million people going to leave, going to leave Canada? It's nonsense, right?
So, no, it's just nonsense.
What I mean is you can understand some guilt-ridden white liberal.
Oh, yeah.
It's stolen land. But then she isn't going to, you know, give her house to
And so much of the land,
sort of thing,
so much of the land was uninhabited or so sparsely inhabited. It'd be like, you know, they'd find the skeletal remains of some hunter who got lost. This is a common joke. Oh, you know, some one of the tribes, hunter, he got lost up in the north. So we find his skeletal remains, you know, hundreds of years later, and could say, oh, see, that's where their tribe lived. And it's like, well, except for there's no evidence of anyone else around for, you know, hundreds of kilometers. You know, like, so, but I mean, in terms of those tribal people, now European people, yeah, because they were busy building farms and communities, you know, towns and villages, maybe the odd city, depending on how far north you go. But, you know, a lot of Canada really didn't have a whole lot of people in it.
It's also interesting because, like, Brantford in Ontario is not traditional Iroquois land. It's land that they took from the Hurons. So that whole reservation, like a Brantford, is not even theirs. Like, they shouldn't even be there. Their homeland is upstate New York. Most of the Iroquois actually live in upstate New York.
And that's where the little Oka thing. I remember going to the longhouse there as a kid with, like, the school.
Yeah. So, like, they're just dead ass not even from Brantford. That's not their land. That's all Huron land.
And that's around where the whole Oka incident happened, isn't it?
Oka happened close to Ganawage. That, in fairness, like, this might catch me some flack. That entire situation on both sides was a total disaster. It should not have happened because the state really, like, mobilized for war for a golf course.
It was literally because some
fucking boomer wanted that land for a golf course, and it's like, dude, if these people were taking pot shots at cops, I could understand mobilizing the military. I could understand, like, a crazy response, but it's like all of this literally started over a golf course.
It's not
even like the Quebec government wanted to use the land for resources, or that there was, like, an oil deposit, or there was precious metals or diamonds or anything. It was just straight up for a golf course. So that's actually what that was about. It was the mayor getting into a disagreement, and then they called in the province, who then called in the federal government, because the indigenous were smuggling. They're getting weaponry smuggled in from the states through the state of New York.
You know, what's crazy is that the iconic photo from Oka, that Canadian Reserve man, that was, like, staring down the indigenous person with the Kalashnikov. Apparently, like, later on, he became, like, a porn star, and they, like, reenacted that scene with the native woman.
So, horrific. Yeah, absolutely horrific.
Oh, man.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think seems like a good point to end this one. I mean, it's been a very active conversation, but I think we're all a bit tired now.
Well, you definitely, because you're much later into the evening.
Well, yes, but I change my sleeping pattern.
Yeah. What was the creature of the night?
See, here it's only, you know, about 7 o'clock at night, so it's not that
bloody late. Hell. Well, here it's 3:15 in the morning.
7:15 here. So 7:15 p.m. though. Yeah.
Well, I think we started off with 9 people, and we've whittled it down to just 3 now. So it's been quite a ride. But yeah, I've enjoyed it, and I hope you guys have as well.
Yeah, of course.
A very varied conversation. Tomorrow I'll be back with, let me just see, I think it's the Scottish. Yeah, it's the Scottish one, and then the one and all banquet, which will be open to the general public. So fuck knows how that's going to go. I've said this many times. I'm still quite nervous about it. But that will begin at midnight, 21 hours from now. Like 7 p.m. EST tomorrow.
So yeah, that. But before that will be the Scottish one with Count Dankula and herd immunity and no chance. And let me see who else. I'm not sure. There are going to be three. So yeah, that's tomorrow. So, but for now, I guess I should head off. So thank you to everyone who took part in this. And I will see you tomorrow. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you.
Take it easy, Wallace, and thank you.
Good evening. Excellent. Bye. All right. See y'all later.
On this anniversary year, a true bounty can be found in the merchandise store. T-shirts, mugs, and an incredible range of posters. All exclusive products. Every one the perfect way to remember this unique time. At the end of the festival, a very special poster will be available, but no need to wait for that. See what you can pick up today.